Jim. How I envy him.
The professor of history said,
"They made a silly mistake, though. After the interval, we did a little piece by Dowland for a recorder and a keyboard, you know. Well, the reporter chap must have not been listening or something. Anyway, there it was, in the paper, as large as life. And what do you think they said?"
"I don't know, Professor," Dixon said in sober veracity. No other professor in Great Britain, he thought, set such store by being called Professor.
"Flute! And piano!"
Professor Welch laughed briefly.
"Now, a recorder, you know, isn't like a flute, though it's the flute's immediate ancestor, of course. Well, to begin with, it's played what they call a bec, that's to say..."
Together, they resembled some kind of variety act. Welch tall and weedy, Dixon on the short side, fair and round-faced.
There was this most marvellous mix-up just before the interval. My word!
Quickly deciding on his own word, Dixon said it to himself, and then tried to flail his features into some sort of response, telling himself that this man had decisive power over his future. He must try to make Welch like him, and one way of doing that was, he supposed, to be present and conscious while Welch talked about concerts. But did Welch notice who else was there while he talked? And if he noticed, did he remember? Abruptly, the second of Dixon's two predicaments flapped up into consciousness. "How's Margaret?" he asked. Welch's attention, like a squadron of old battleships, began wheeling to face this new phenomenon.
Margaret.
"Yes, I've not seen her for a week or two." "Or three," Dixon added uneasily to himself.
"Oh, she's recovering very quickly, all things considered. She took a nasty knock, of course, over that catchpole fellow, and the unfortunate business afterwards."
Dixon felt constrained to say, "I think living with you and Mrs. Welch must have helped her a lot."
"Yes, I think there must be something about the atmosphere of the place, you know, that has some sort of healing effect."
After a pensive halt, Welch said he had to go up and collect his bag from his room. While he waited, Dixon felt apprehension lunging at his stomach as he thought of seeing Margaret, whom he was to take out that evening for the first time since she'd tried to commit suicide. He'd been drawn into the Margaret business by a combination of virtues he hadn't known he possessed. Friendly interest, concern, a willingness to be imposed upon. Then, suddenly, he'd become the man who was going round with Margaret, and somehow competing with this catchpole. He'd thought a couple of months earlier that catchpole was coming along nicely, taking the strain off him. And then catchpole had thrown her over, and his destiny as the only recipient of those unmanning questions could hardly be eluded. Although he wasn't allowed to smoke another cigarette until 5 o'clock, Dixon lit one now, as he remembered. The beginning of December it had been, 7 or 8 weeks after he took up his appointment at the university. "Do you like coming to see me?" was the first of Margaret's questions he could recall. Then there'd been ones like, "Am I the only girl you know in this place?" And, "Are we going to go on seeing so much of each other?" His first qualms had dated from then. What would she be wearing this evening? He could just about bring himself to praise anything but the green paisley frock in combination with the quasi-velvet shoes. Where was Welch? The old man was well known for an incurable evader. Dixon clattered down the stairs into the staff cloakroom. Welch was there, stooped over a washbasin.
"Ah," Dixon said convivially. "Thought you'd gone without me, Professor."
"Gone?"
"Yes, you're taking me home for tea. We arranged it on Monday."
Dixon caught sight of his face in the mirror and was surprised to see that it wore an expression of eager friendliness.
"Oh, did we say this afternoon?"
Welch began a slow drying of his hands.
"That's right, Professor. Hope it's still convenient."
"Oh, it's convenient enough. We'll go down in my car."
Outside, Dixon stared about him while Welch looked thoroughly for his keys. A bus passed slowly up the hill in the mild May sunshine, bound for the small town where the Welches lived. Dixon bettered himself. It would be there before them.
A minute later, he was sitting listening to a sound like a cracked doorbell as Welch pulled at the starter. The car burst from a standstill towards the grass verge, which Welch ran over briefly before turning down the drive, the engine maintaining a loud lowing sound, which caused a group of students to stare after them. They climbed College Road, holding to the middle of the highway. The unavailing hoots of a lorry behind them made Dixon look furtively at Welch, whose face he saw with passion held an expression of calm assurance, like an old quartermaster's in rough weather.
Dixon?
Dixon did everything possible with the side of his face away from Welch, which might help to relieve his feelings in advance.
Yes, Professor? I was wondering about that article of yours. Have you heard yet?
Well, yes. Actually, I told you that Partington said he couldn't find room for it.
Oh, well, of course, they do get a lot of the most... Have you sent it off to anyone else?
Yes, that Caton chap who advertised in the Times Literary Supplement. He's starting up a new historical review or something.
Ah, yes, yes, a new journal might be worth trying. There was one advertised in the Times Literary Supplement a little while ago, Peyton or some such name.
Dixon looked out of the window. It wasn't the double exposure effect of the last half-minute's talk that dumbfounded him. It was the prospect of the article he'd written. Unable to contemplate it, he looked to his left, to find a man's face staring into his own from about 9 inches away. The face, which filled with alarm as he gazed, belonged to the driver of a van which Welch had elected to pass on a sharp bend between two stone walls. A huge bus now swung into view from further round the bend. Before Dixon could roll himself into a ball, or even take off his glasses, the van had braked and disappeared, and the bus driver, his mouth opening and shutting vigorously, had somehow squirmed his vehicle against the far wall. Dixon, though on the whole glad at this escape, felt at the same time that the conversation would have been appropriately rounded off by Welch's death. He felt this more keenly when Welch went on,
"If I were you, I should take all the steps I possibly could to get this article accepted in the next month or so. You see, Faulkner, it's rather important to you that it should turn out to be worth something, if you see what I mean."
Despite being wrongfully addressed, Faulkner had preceded him in his post. Dixon knew what Welch meant. How had he made his bad impression? The most likely thing was having inflicted a superficial wound on the professor of English in his first week. Coming round a corner, Dixon had kicked at a small round stone, and it had struck the professor of English just below the left kneecap at a distance of 15 yards or more. Welch said in a half-shout,
"Oh, by the way, Dixon, I've been wondering if you'd care to come over next weekend. We're having a few people, you know, friends of ours, and of my son Bertram's. I expect we shall put on one or two little shows. We'll probably call on you to lend a hand."
"Thank you very much," Dixon said.
"And there's something else I'd like to discuss. I've been talking to the principal about the college open week, and I thought you might care to tackle the department's evening lecture. Something like Merry England might do as a subject."
Margaret Peel, small, thin, bespectacled, and with bright makeup, glanced up at Dixon. They were sitting at the bar in a large roadside hotel not far from Welch's home. "And then, just before I went under, I suddenly stopped caring. I just thought, oh, well, here we go. It doesn't matter all that much." "Curious sensation. Did Wilson tell you about how he found me?"
"Well, the chap in the room underneath? Oh, yes, he said about hearing your wireless booming away and coming up to complain."
"What made you leave it on like that?"
She looked away. "I don't really know, James. It seemed so horribly quiet in that room. Everybody was awfully sweet to me afterwards, and then you came to see me, and you looked so terrible."
She leaned sideways in laughter, her hands clasped round one knee, the quasi-velvet shoe falling away from her heel. "You looked as if you had been watching some frightful, gruesome operation." Still laughing quietly, she pulled her cardigan up over the shoulders of the green paisley frock. Having first drunk freely from his glass, Dixon said, "You are over this business now, aren't you? You wouldn't think of having another shot, I mean."
"Oh, no, I don't care about him anymore."
"Good," Dixon said heartily.
"Has he tried to get in touch with you or anything?" Not a thing. I suppose he's too busy with his popsy these days, like he said he'd be. She drained her glass with a quick, gay movement. Beer, she said. Buy me beer. The night is young.
While he was getting the drinks, Dixon wondered why Margaret, with her lecturer's salary, so rarely volunteered to stand him a drink. Then he thought of the morning before Margaret had taken her overdose. He could remember exactly how she'd looked, glancing up to say, "If you've got nothing better to do tonight, I'll be brewing up about 10. In the event, the prospect of another conference about Catchpole had seemed uninviting, and at about 10 she'd eaten a whole bottleful of pills. The next time he'd seen her was in the hospital a week later.
"Oh, by the way, James," she said, "I want to say how grateful I am for your tact these last couple of weeks in keeping in the background. You were the only one who took the trouble to work out that I might prefer not to be bombarded with kind inquiries."
Dixon alerted his faculties. Conundrums that sounded innocuous were the most reliable sign of impending attack, the mysterious horseman sighted riding towards the bullion coach. But it seemed genuine. She had been known to interpret some of his laziest actions in this light. Perhaps he could now begin to lead the talk somewhere else.
Will you still be at the Welch's next weekend? What, for Neddy's arty get-together? Of course. You don't mean you're coming, do you?
Margaret laughed in the way Dixon had named to himself the tinkle of tiny silver bells. He sometimes thought that the whole corpus of her behaviour derived from translating such phrases into action.
Oh, what's so funny? I can waffle with the best of them. What's been laid on?
She ticked the items off on her fingers. Part songs, demonstration of some sword dance steps, recitations, a chamber concert.
Oh, my God. You'll have to find out what he's got lined up for me so I can think up reasons for not being able to do it.
She laid her hand on his. You can rely on me, she said. But don't let's talk about it any more. Can't we talk about ourselves? We've got so much to say to each other, haven't we?
Oh, yes, of course, Dixon said, trying to stuff comradeliness into his tone.
Margaret heaved the sigh which invariably preluded the worst avowals. How close we seem to be tonight, James, she said. A man on the other side of her turned and stared. All the barriers are down at last, aren't they?
Finding this unanswerable, Dixon slowly nodded his head. He thought how nice it would be if he could pack a few clothes and get on the 10:40 for London.
Dixon was leaving college in a hurry after a lecture.
Excuse me, Mr. Dixon. Have you got a minute?
Mitchy was a moustached ex-service student who'd commanded a tank troop at Anzio while Dixon was an RAF corporal in Western Scotland. As always, his manner seemed to be concealing something, though Dixon could never be sure what.
Have you got that syllabus together yet, sir? He said.
He was the only student Dixon had ever heard calling a member of the staff, sir.
Oh, that syllabus, Dixon said, playing for time.
He hadn't got it together yet.
I've got the stuff ready in my digs, but I've not given it to the typist yet. I'll try to have it ready for you early next week, if that's all right.
Oh, that'll do beautifully, sir,
Mitchy said, his moustache writhing a little as he smiled. The getting together of the syllabus had been Welch's idea. On receipt of it, the candidates for honours in history were to see whether they were interested in studying a new special subject, medieval life and culture. So far, Dixon's efforts had been confined to aiming to secure for it the three prettiest girls in the class, one of whom was Mitchy's girl, while excluding Mitchy himself.
"What are your ideas so far, sir, if you don't mind my asking?" Mitchy asked as they turned into College Road.
Dixon did mind, but said only, "Well, I thought I might start with a discussion of the university and its social role."
He comforted himself for having said this by the thought that at least he knew it didn't mean anything.
"You don't propose to offer an analysis of scholasticism, then?"
This question illustrated exactly why Dixon felt he had to keep Mitchy out. Mitchy knew a lot, or seemed to, which was as bad. One of the things he knew, or seemed to, was what scholasticism was. Dixon read, heard, and even used the word a dozen times a day without knowing, though he seemed to.
"No, I'm afraid there won't be much meat in it from that point of view," he said. "I'm not qualified to pronounce on the learned Scotus or Aquinas, I'm afraid. Or should it have been Augustine?" They parted at the foot of College Road, Mitchy to his hall of residence, and Dixon to his digs.
As he crossed the street to his front door, Dixon thought of Welch. Would Welch have asked him to get up a special subject if he wasn't going to keep him on as a lecturer? Substitute any human name for Welch's, and the answer must be no. But retain the original reading, and no certainty was possible. On the hall stand were a couple of periodicals, something in a typed envelope for Alfred Beasley, who was a member of the college's English department, and another addressed to J. Dickinson, with a London postmark. Dixon hesitated, then opened it. Inside was a sheet hastily torn from a pad bearing a few ill-written lines in green ink. Without formality, the writer announced that he'd liked Dixon's article and proposed to publish it in due course. He signed himself L.S. Caton. Dixon did a little dance in the narrow hall. Welch would find it harder to sack him now. He glanced idly at the periodicals, which were destined for Evan Johns, office worker at the college and amateur oboist. One of them bore a photograph of a contemporary composer Johns might reasonably be supposed to admire. Dixon quickly began altering the face with a soft pencil. The lower lip he turned into a set of discoloured snaggle teeth. Dueling scars appeared on the cheeks. Hairs sprang from the nostrils. He'd added a Chinese moustache and pirate's earrings when somebody began to come in by the front door. Dixon sprang into the dining room and peered through the door crack. After a few seconds, he came out and said, "Hello, Alfred." Beasley was reading his letter, scowling as he did so. "Coming into tea?" Beasley nodded and handed Dixon the cyclostyled sheet. Dixon read that Beasley was thanked for his application, but that Mr. P. Oldham had been appointed to the post. "Oh, bad luck, Alfred. Still, there'll be others, won't there?" "Oh, doubt it for October. Time's running short." They took their seats at the tea table. "Anything new from Neddy Welch about your chances?"
"No, but that chap Caton's taken my article."
Dixon passed the letter over.
"Not too fussy about stationery and so on, is he? Oh, I see. Well, you'll be wanting more definite information than that. Vague acceptance isn't much use to anyone. You pin him down to a date, then you'll have got some real evidence to give Neddy. Take my advice."
Their conversation broke off at the entry of insurance salesman and ex-army major Bill Atkinson. Tall and very dark, Atkinson sat weightily down at his place. He studied Dixon closely when the latter said, "You're early today, Bill," as if the remark might have carried some challenge to his physical strength or endurance. His centre-parted black hair and rectangular moustache gave him an air of archaic ferocity. The conversation ran on the subject of Dixon's article until Beasley left them. Dixon waited a moment before saying, "Oh, Bill, I wonder if you could do me a favour. Could you ring me at this number about 11 on Sunday morning?" He paused at a small, unidentifiable sound, but heard nothing further and continued, "If you can't get hold of me, tell whoever answers that my parents have turned up out of the blue and will I please get back as soon as I can. There, I've written everything down." Atkinson studied the back of the envelope as if it bore the wrong answer to a chess problem. "It's one of my professor's arty weekends. I've got to turn up, but I can't face the whole of Sunday there." There was a long pause while Atkinson looked censoriously around the room. Dixon liked and revered him for his air of detesting everything that presented itself to his senses and of not meaning to let this detestation become staled by custom. Atkinson said finally, "I see. I'll enjoy doing that." As he said this, Evan Johns came into the room. Asking himself whether Johns had overheard, Dixon felt a twinge of disquiet. Johns was a friend of the Welches. Mrs. Welch, at the piano, played a slow arpeggio. "All right, everybody?" A soporific droning filled the air as the singers hummed their notes to one another. Next to Dixon was Cecil Goldsmith, a colleague in the history department, whose tenor voice held enough savage power to obliterate whatever noises Dixon might feel himself impelled to make. Dixon ran his eye along the lines of black dots, which seemed to go up and down a good deal. He'd had a bad setback in some Brahms rubbish, which began with 10 seconds or so of unsupported tenor, more accurately of unsupported Goldsmith, who twice dried up in face of a tricky interval and left Dixon opening and shutting his mouth in silence. Dixon now cautiously reproduced the note Goldsmith was humming. The madrigal began. when from my love I looked for love and kind affections due. Dixon kept his head down and looked through the words the others were singing. He read, "Too well I found her vows to prove most faithless and untrue." He looked over at Margaret and wondered what changes in their circumstances and temperaments would be necessary to make the words apply, however remotely, to himself and her. "Yet by and by they'll all deny and say 'twas but unjust," Goldsmith sang loudly. It was the last phrase. Dixon kept his mouth open while Welch's finger remained aloft, then shut it with a little flick of the head he'd seen singers used as the finger swept sideways.
"Well done," Welch said. "Now, this next one's rather well known. It's called Now is the Month of Maying. If you're all just,
A snuffle of laughter came from Dixon's rear. He glanced round to see Evan Johns's eyes fixed on him. "What's the joke?" he asked.
"You'll see," John said.
In less than a minute, Dixon did see, and clearly. Instead of the four customary parts, the third and fourth lines of music from the top had tenor one and tenor two written against them. Even Welch's ear might be expected to record the complete absence of one of the parts in such circumstances. It was much too late now for Dixon to explain that he hadn't really meant it when he'd said he could read music after a fashion. But just then, the door at the far end of the room burst open and was followed by the entry of a tall man wearing a lemon-yellow sports coat, all three buttons of which were fastened, and displaying a large beard which came down further on one side than on the other. Dixon guessed that this must be Welch's pacifist painting son, Bertrand, whose arrival with his girl had been heralded by Welch every few minutes since tea time. Dixon delightedly lit a cigarette and leaned against the wall. Placed here, he was in a good position to observe Bertrand's girl when she came in a few seconds later. This must be the one that Margaret had told him about, the ballet student. In a few more seconds, Dixon had noticed all he needed to notice about her. The combination of fair hair, straight and cut short, with brown eyes and no lipstick, the large breasts and the narrow waist. The notion that women like this were never on view except as the property of men like Bertrand was so familiar to him that it had long since ceased to appear an injustice. A high, baying voice called, "Ah, there you are, darling," and Bertrand strode up the room to meet her, throwing Dixon a brief, hostile glance. Dixon kept out of the way for a time. Then he moved down and started talking to Margaret. Bertrand was doing a lot of laughing as he told some lengthy story. His girl watched him intently, as if he might ask her later to summarise his drift. Then Welch came up to Dixon and said,
"Ah, Dixon, Margaret, I want you to meet Bertrand and his, come along."
He introduced them, and Margaret said, "Are you down here for long, Mr. Welch?"
"I doubt it," Bertrand said. He smiled among his beard.
"I have miscellaneous concerns in London, but it's very pleasant to know that the torch of culture is still in a state of combustion in the provinces."
"What work do you do?" asked Dixon flatly.
"I am a painter. Not, alas, pictures of trade unionists or town halls or naked women, or I should now be able to retire. No, just pictures, mere pictures. And what work do you do? Always provided, of course, that I have permission to ask."
"I'm one of your father's underlings. I cover the medieval angle for the history department here."
Bertrand's girl said, "You enjoy doing that, do you?"
"Oh, it has its appeal," Dixon said, "though I can quite see that it hasn't the glamour of the ballet."
As he spoke, he gave Bertrand a smile of polite envy. The girl repeated with genuine bewilderment, "The ballet? But I work in a bookshop." Bertrand was going red in the face, and Dixon was attacked by the fear that ballet might be a private Welsh synonym for sexual intercourse.
"Look here, Dickinson, or whatever your name is," Bertrand began. "Perhaps you think you're being very funny, but I'd as soon you cut it out, if you don't mind."
"I'm terribly sorry," Dixon said, "but I wasn't under the impression..."
But before he could continue, Welch, of all people, had come in loudly with,
"Poor old Dixon. Must have been confusing this, young lady with Sonia Loosemore, a friend of Bertrand's who let us all down rather badly some time ago."
"Don't worry about it, Mr. Dixon," the girl cut in. "It was only a silly little misunderstanding. My name's Christine Callahan. Altogether different, you see." They moved off. and Dixon was left alone with Margaret.
"Here, have a cigarette," she said. "You must be needing one. It's rather queer, isn't it? He was going to marry the Loosemore, and now here he is with a new piece. Pretty, though, that Christine what's-her-name?"
Dixon tensed himself for the inevitable qualification.
"Still, a pretty face covers a multitude, is what I always say."
Dixon thought this profoundly true, but debarred from saying so, was at a loss what to reply. He looked round. The company was moving about. The next stage of the evening was clearly imminent.
"What's the next item on the programme, Professor?" he asked. "Oh, just one or two instrumental items."
Dixon nodded, as if pleased. Dixon helped to arrange some chairs for the next part of the concert. He returned to find Margaret in conversation with Carol Goldsmith. This woman, aged about 40, with long, straight brown hair, Dixon regarded as one of his allies.
"Hello, Jim. How's it going?" she asked.
"Badly."
"Yes. Why do we come to this sort of thing?"
"Why, it'd hardly be worth coming just to meet the great painter, would it?" Dixon said. For a reason he didn't understand, the reception of this remark was perceptibly unfavourable.
"What makes you say that?"
"Oh, well, nothing really," Dixon said in alarm. "I had a little brush with him just now, that's all. He was a bit offensive, I thought."
"Oh, that's quite typical. He always thinks he's being got at. He often is, too."
"Oh, you know him, do you? Well, I'm sorry, Carol. Is he a pal of yours?"
"Well, hardly that. We saw a bit of him last summer, Cecil and I. He can be quite entertaining at times, actually."
A great baying laugh made them turn round. Bertrand, leading Goldsmith by the arm, was approaching. With the remnants of his laughter still trickling from his face, he said to Carol,
"Ah, there you are, dear girl. And how are things with you?"
Well enough, thank you, dear man. I can see how things are with you. A bit out of your usual run, isn't she?"
"Christine? Ah, now there's a grand girl for you."
"Any plans for her?"
"Plans? No plans at all. At the moment, quite frankly, she's made me more than a little piqued."
How's that, Bertrand?" Goldsmith asked.
"Well, as you may imagine," he nodded towards the piano, "this isn't quite enough to draw me down here unaided, glad as I am to see you all. No, I had been promised a meeting with Julius Gore Urquhart, of whom you may have heard."
Dixon had indeed heard of Gore Urquhart, a rich devotee of the arts who had a house in the neighbourhood. Apparently the Callahan girl was his niece or something, and she had arranged to introduce Bertrand to him during the current weekend. But at some late stage it had been found that Gore Urquhart was at present in Paris, so that a further visit would have to be undertaken to meet him.
"I have it on good authority," Bertrand said, "that our influential friend will shortly be declaring his private secretaryship vacant, and I'm at the moment busily engaged in grooming myself for the part. Patronage, you see, patronage. I'll answer his letters with one hand and paint with the other."
"When do you think you'll be down again, then, old boy?" Goldsmith asked. "We'll have to fix something up."
"Oh, in a fortnight or so, I expect."
"That's the weekend of the summer ball," Margaret said. "Will you be coming again this year, Mr. Welch?"
"Oh, I might manage it, I suppose. I remember being not unentertained last time." "They won't be able to keep you away, Cecil, I suppose."
"I'm afraid they will. There's a conference of teachers of history then at Leeds."
"Oh, dear, dear, that's most unfortunate. Will any other members of the company be attending?"
Margaret glanced at Dixon, and Carol said,
"What about you, Jim?"
Dixon shook his head firmly. No, I've never been much of a dancing man, I'm afraid." It would be terrible if Margaret blackmailed him into taking her. At that moment, the door opened, and the Callahan woman came in.
"Ah, my dear," Bertrand said. "We've been discussing Mr. Gore Urquhart and wondering whether he'll be available the weekend after next, there being a species of dancing festivity at the college during that time. Can you enlighten us, I wonder?"
"Well, his secretary said he'd probably be in Paris till the middle of next month. I've written to Uncle asking him to let me know when he's coming back."
As ever, Margaret thought of something to say. "I was reading about your uncle only recently, Miss Callahan. He was presenting some watercolours to our gallery here. I don't know what we should do without someone like him to keep things going."
Yes, he is very generous," the Callahan girl said.
Bertrand said, "Well, he won't be able to be much longer, I fear, if the lads at Transport House go on running our lives for us."
Oh, I don't think this crowd have done too badly, Goldsmith put in.
Their foreign policy might, I agree, have been a good deal worse.
Bertrand looked quickly round the group.
But their home policy, soak the rich. I mean, I take it that it is just that and no more, isn't it?
Pretending not to notice Margaret's warning frown, Dixon said,
Well, what's wrong with it? If one man's got 10 buns and another's got 2, and a bun has got to be given up, then surely you take it from the man with 10 buns.
Bertrand and his girl were looking at each other with identical expressions. It was as if Dixon had just said that he didn't know anything about art, but he did know what he liked. But we don't think anybody need give up a bun, the girl said. That's the whole point.
Well, hardly the whole point, I should have thought.
The point is that the rich play an essential role, Bertrand said, his voice baying a little more noticeably. An essential role in keeping the arts going. And I'll tell you something else. I happen to like rich people. They're charming, they're generous, their houses are full of beautiful things. And that's why I like them, all right?
Come along, dear, Mrs. Welch called. If we wait for Father, we'll be here all night. Shall we make a start? If you'll come over here, we can all sit down. The group began to dissolve. But before he moved himself, Bertrand said, his eyes on Dixon,
Quite clear? You'd better make the most of them, then, while you've got 'em, said Dixon angrily, because you won't have 'em much longer, you know.
He began to push past. But the Callaghan girl halted him by saying, I'd rather you didn't talk in that strain, if you don't mind. They all sat down together in a row. I always get a bit irritated by that sort of thing. I'm sorry, it's just a thing about me, I'm afraid. If Dixon hadn't learnt to dislike this argument when offered by Margaret, he probably wouldn't have answered as he did, Seen anybody about it yet? The music had by this time begun, and Bertrand leaned over and said in a loud undertone,
Look here, Dixon, you're talking as if you want a ruddy good punch on the nose.
Dixon, when moved, was bad at ordering his thoughts. If I did, you don't think you're the one to give it to me, do you?
All right. Coming outside for a bit, Bertrand asked. Dixon got up.
Shh, said the rest of the company. Bertrand half rose to follow, but his girl stopped him. Before Dixon could reach the door, it opened and Welch entered.
Oh, I shan't be long, Professor, Dixon said. I just think I'll,
He made some gestures meant to be indecipherable.
I'll be back.
He shut the door on Welch's wondering frown. It was hard work walking up the dry, sandy track to the Welch's house, especially with so much beer distributed about his frame. Dixon had spent more than he could afford and drunk more than he ought, and yet he felt nothing but satisfaction and peace. The large, long room at the back of the house, where the music had been going on, was in darkness. Oh, that was good. Further round, however, there were lights and voices, and peering through a chink in the curtains, Dixon saw Welch in his raincoat and fishing hat, just going out of the door, followed by Cecil Goldsmith. People were evidently about to be driven home. Carol Goldsmith stayed for a moment to exchange a last remark with Bertrand. Nobody else was in the room. Dixon couldn't catch the words now spoken by Bertrand. He could tell from their intonation, however, that they formed a question to which Carol said, Yes, all right. At this, Bertrand put his arms round her. Dixon went back to the music room and got in through the French window. What he'd seen had disturbed him. To have talked to Cecil Goldsmith several times a week somehow gave Goldsmith a claim on Dixon which was invoked by the sight of his wife being handled by a third party. Dixon wished he hadn't found that gap in the curtains. He crossed the hall and creaked up the stairs. Through some architectural vagary, his bedroom could only be approached by way of a bathroom, the outer door of which he now tried to open. Nothing happened. The bathroom was evidently occupied. Dixon went into a manic flurry of obscene gestures. Just then, somebody opened a door on the other side of the landing. There was no time to do anything at all except adopt the attitude of one waiting outside a bathroom.
James! What on earth are you doing?
Never had Dixon been so glad to see Margaret rather than anyone else. She beckoned him into her bedroom.
Where have you been all evening, James?
While he told her, her resentful expression soon overrode his feelings of relief.
What would it be like if they ever got married?
At the same time, she looked at her best in that blue dressing gown. For a few minutes, they talked. Then Margaret said,
Don't you think you ought to be going? It's getting late.
Oh, I know. I will in a minute. I'm enjoying this.
So am I.
It's the first time we've been really alone for... how long? Afterwards, Dixon could never quite work out why he did what he did next, which was sitting down beside Margaret on the bed and kissing her firmly on the mouth. Whatever his motives, the blue dressing gown, the pints of local bitter, his wish to bring their relations to some crisis, the effects were unequivocal. She kissed him back with zeal. Dixon twitched off his, then her, spectacles and put them down somewhere. He kissed her again harder. He felt his head spin. Why shouldn't he go on? Did he want to? Well, yes, in a way. But was it fair to her? Was it fair to him? He could only just handle her as a female friend. On the other hand, he felt her breath on his cheek, and desire which had been failing suddenly strengthened. Without hesitation, he advanced further. There was a brief rolling struggle, then he found himself flung sideways. Margaret got up, adjusting her dressing gown. "Go on," she said. "Out you go, James." He struggled to his feet.
"I'm sorry, what's the matter?"
"Out!" She opened the door, and he found himself bundled outside. Again he tried to open the bathroom door. It was again locked, and Dixon let loose a prolonged bray of rage, which recalled Goldsmith's performance in The Madrigals. Then he clumped down the stairs and into the dining room. In a moment he'd taken a bottle of port from the fake 18th-century sideboard. From this very bottle, Welch had the previous evening poured Dixon the smallest drink he'd ever been seriously offered. He drank deeply, wiped his mouth on the sideboard runner, and, feeling splendid, gained his bedroom without opposition. Slowly, he began getting ready for bed. His four surviving cigarettes, had he really smoked 12 that evening, lay in their packet on a polished table at the bedhead. On the mantelpiece was a china effigy of a well-known Oriental religious figure. Had Welch put it there as a silent sermon to him on the merits of the contemplative life? If so, the message had come too late. He turned off the light, and the room began to rise upwards from the right-hand bottom corner of the bed. He threw back the covers and sat on the edge of the bed. The room composed itself to rest. After a few moments, he lay down. The room lifted. He put his feet to the floor. The room stayed still. He put his legs on the bed, but didn't lie down. The room moved. He was evidently in a highly critical condition. He heaped up the pillows, half lay against them, and dangled his legs half over the edge of the bed. In this position, he was able to lower himself gingerly into sleep. Dixon lay sprawled, too wicked to move, spewed up like a broken spider crab on the tarry shingle of the morning. He resolved, having done it once, never to move his eyeballs again. His mouth had been used as a latrine by some small creature of the night, and then as its mausoleum. During the night, too, he'd somehow been expertly beaten up by secret police. He felt bad. He reached out for and put on his glasses. At once he saw that something was wrong with the bedclothes. Endangering his chance of survival, he sat up, and what met his eyes roused to a frenzy the tympanist in his head. A large area of the sheet was missing. A smaller but still considerable area of the blanket was missing. An area about the size of the palm of his hand and the main part of the top blanket was missing. The three holes, appropriately enough, had black borders. A cigarette must have burnt itself out on the bedclothes. But where was it now? He leaned over the side of the bed, gritting his teeth. A sunken brown channel lay across the pattern of a valuable-looking rug. This made him feel very unhappy, a feeling sensibly increased when he looked at the bedside table. This was marked by two black, charred grooves. Had he done all this himself? Or had a wayfarer, a burglar, camped out in his room? He thought that on the whole he must have done it himself, and wished he hadn't. He got out of bed and went into the bathroom. After a minute or two, he returned carrying a safety razor blade. Carefully, he started cutting round the edges of the burnt areas of the bedclothes. When all the edges were smooth and regular, he knelt down and shaved the appropriate part of the rug. He sat on the bed for a moment to recover, then went into the bathroom again. He looked at himself in the steamy mirror. He didn't look too bad, really. Anyway, better than he felt. Returning to the bedroom, he again surveyed the mutilated bedclothes.
They looked in some way unsatisfactory, though he couldn't have said how. He went and locked the outer bathroom door, picked up the razor blade, and began again on the circumferences of the holes. Finally, he stood back and decided the effect was perceptibly better. The disaster now seemed much less obviously the work of man and might be put down to some fulminant dry rot or the ravages of a colony of moths. He was considering taking the bedside table downstairs and later throwing it out of the bus on his journey back when the locked bathroom door handle was rattled. The rattling went on until there was a final orgasm of shakings, knockings and thuddings. Then footsteps retreated. Dixon waited until a door closed. Then he unlocked the bathroom and left. The only person in the breakfast room was the Callahan girl. Dixon quickly decided on a bluff, speak-my-mind approach. "Afraid I got off on the wrong foot with you last night," he said. "Oh, that. I shouldn't worry too much about it if I were you. I didn't show up too well myself." "Nice of you to take it like that," he said. There was a pause while he noted with mild surprise how much she was eating. The remains of a large pool of sauce were to be seen on her plate beside fried egg, bacon and tomatoes. Even as he watched, she replenished her stock of sauce. She caught his look of interest. "I'm sorry, I like sauce."
"Oh, no, that's all right," he said. "I'm fond of this stuff myself."
But a study of the egg and bacon and tomatoes opposite him made him decide to postpone eating. He poured a cup of black coffee.
"Aren't you going to have any of this stuff?" the girl asked. "Well, not yet, I don't think." "Well, what's the matter? Aren't you feeling so good?"
"No, not really. I must admit, a bit of a headache, you know."
"Everybody wondered where you'd got to last night."
"Yeah, I've no doubt they did. Tell me, did Professor Welch seem irritated by my absence?"
"I really have no idea. I don't know him at all, you see, so I couldn't really tell."
"I shall have to apologise to him, I suppose," Dixon said.
Suddenly he remembered the bedclothes. He couldn't possibly leave them like that. He must do something else to them.
"I'm afraid I shall have to dash," he said.
"Well, have you got to get back?"
"No, I mean, I've got to go upstairs."
Realising that this was a poor exit line, he said wildly,
"There's something wrong with my room, something I must alter. I had a fire last night."
Her eyes dilated.
"Your bedroom caught fire?"
"No, no, only the bed. I lit it with a cigarette."
"You set fire to your bed?"
"That's right."
"Well, why didn't you put it out?"
"I was asleep. I didn't know about it till I woke up."
"How bad is it?"
"Oh, bad enough. The great piece is gone altogether, you see."
"Oh, well, I don't really know what to suggest without seeing it. Unless you..." "Well, no, that wouldn't help."
"Look," Dixon said, "I suppose you wouldn't come up and have a look at it?"
"Yes."
"Do you think you could?"
"All right. I don't guarantee anything, of course."
They went in file up the stairs. The ocarina-like notes of a recorder were distantly audible. Perhaps Welch had breakfasted in his room. Dixon opened the bathroom door. The girl looked sternly at him.
"What are we going in here for?"
"Oh, my bedroom's on the far side."
"Oh, what a curious arrangement."
"Oh, I imagine old Welch had this part of the house built on."
"I suppose so."
"My goodness, you certainly have gone to town, haven't you?" She went forward and fingered the sheet. "But this doesn't look like a burn. It looks as if it's been cut with something."
"Yes, I cut the burnt bits off with a razor blade. I thought it would look better."
"Hmm." She seemed to consider.
"Well, I think the best thing would be to remake the bed with all this mess at the bottom out of sight."
Dixon heaved the bed away from the wall, and they both set about unmaking and remaking. As they worked, Dixon saw with fury that she was even prettier than he'd thought. She aroused in him a mess of feelings. Indignation, grief, resentment, peevishness, spite, and sterile anger. The girl was doubly guilty, first of looking like that, secondly of appearing in front of him looking like that. Run-of-the-mill Italian film actresses and girls on calendars he could put up with. More than that, he positively liked looking at them. But this sort of thing he'd as soon not look at all. He remembered seeing in a book once that some man had said that love was an emotion quite different from ordinary sexual feelings. Was it love, then, that he felt?
"There, I think that looks very nice," she said. "What are you going to do with the table?"
"Oh, I've been thinking about that. There's a little junk room at the end of the passage. They sent me up there yesterday to fetch a music stand. If you'll see whether the coast's clear, I'll rush along there with it now."
She looked at him for a moment.
and then began to laugh. And Dixon began laughing too, not because he was much amused, but because he felt grateful to her for her laughter. They were still laughing a minute later when she beckoned him outside the bathroom door, when he ran out onto the landing with the table, and when Margaret suddenly flung open the door of her bedroom.
"What do you imagine you're up to, James?" she asked.
The Callahan girl made a noise of incompetently suppressed laughter. Margaret said,
"Just what is all this nonsense?"
"If nobody minds my saying so," the girl interrupted, "I think we'd better get rid of the table first and explain the whys and wherefores afterwards, don't you?"
"That's right," Dixon said, and ran up the passage. In the junk room, he dumped the table behind a screen. Margaret was waiting for him at the threshold of her room. One corner of her mouth was drawn in a way he knew well. The Callahan girl had gone.
"Well, what was all that about, James?"
He shut the door and explained. Without changing her expression, she said,
"Well, the whole thing strikes me as rather silly and childish. You couldn't have gone to Mrs. Welch and explained, of course."
"No, of course is right. I couldn't have. I'd have been out of my job in 5 minutes.
You say it was Christine Callahan's idea to remake the bed.
Well, what about it?"
"You seem to have got on a good deal better with her than you did last night. I thought she was abominably rude just now, barging in and sending you off with the table like that."
Stung, Dixon said, "She was absolutely right. One of the Welches might have turned up at any moment, and if anyone barged in, it was you, not her."
He began regretting this speech well before it was over.
She stared at him with her mouth a little open, then whipped abruptly away from him.
"I'm sorry, I won't barge in again."
"Now, Margaret, you know I didn't mean it like that. You must see..."
He rested his hand in a gesture he hoped was solicitous on her nearer shoulder. But before he could continue, she'd shaken his hand off and begun to talk in a strain that marked the opening, he soon realised, of a totally new phase of the scene they were evidently having.
"Get away! How dare you? Stop pushing and pulling me about. Who do you think you are? You haven't even had the grace to apologise for last night. You behaved disgracefully. I've never given you the least impression. What the hell do you take me for? It isn't as if you didn't know what I've had to put up with all these last weeks."
She went on like this, her body moving jerkily about, shaking the wooden beads about on her multicoloured shirt, and he found himself thinking that her arty get-up seemed oddly at variance with the way she was acting.
People who wore clothes of that sort oughtn't to mind things of this sort. Certainly not as much as Margaret clearly minded.
"I was thinking only yesterday afternoon about the relationship we'd been building up, how valuable it was. I was dead wrong."
"No, you're dead wrong now. You were right then," he broke in. "These things don't stop just like that, you know. Human beings aren't as simple as that."
He went on like this while she looked him in the eyes. The rotten triteness of his words seemed, if anything, to help him meet her gaze.
"Oh, James," she said at last, "do let's stop this for now. I'm terribly tired. Just leave me alone."
Dixon went and lay on his bed, reflecting on the events of the last hour. How well, really, the Callahan girl had behaved, in spite of her standoffishness at times, and how sound her suggestion had been. He remembered uneasily the awful glow of her skin, the distressing clarity of her eyes, the immoderate whiteness of her slightly irregular teeth. Then he cheered up a little as he put it to himself that her attachment to Bertrand was a fair guarantee of her being really very nasty. Yes, Bertrand. He must keep out of his way. Still, if Atkinson phoned punctually, as they'd arranged, he'd be out of the house in well under the hour. Sometime later, there was a loud, baying bawl of, "Dixon, telephone!" In the drawing room, Bertrand was sitting with his parents and his girl. He pointed to the phone with his big head. Dixon picked up the receiver.
"That you, Jim?" said Atkinson's cruel voice. "How are things at Barnum and Bailey's?"
"All the better for hearing your voice, Bill."
While he listened to Atkinson, Dixon watched the Callahan girl listening to something Bertrand was explaining about art. Everything about her looked severe, and yet she didn't mind sheets and charred tabletops, and Margaret did. It was a puzzle.
Raising his voice a little, he said, "Well, thanks very much for ringing, Bill. Apologise to my parents, will you, and tell them I'll be back as soon as I can. Goodbye."
He coughed, then said loudly,
"I'm afraid I've got to be off now. My parents have come to see me unexpectedly."
He paused to give room for any cries of regret. When none came, he hurried on.
Thank you very much for putting me up, Mrs. Welch. I've enjoyed myself very much. And now I'm afraid I really must be off.
Avoiding everybody's eye, he walked through the silence and out of the door.
The hangover had vanished.
Dixon, can I have a word with you?
Dixon followed Professor Welch to his office, wondering if the subject for debate was the burnt sheet or his dismissal, or the sheet and his dismissal. Welch sat down at his misleadingly littered desk.
I was having a chat the other day with an old friend of mine, a professor at the University College of Abertawi, he is now, Athro Haynes. Apparently this Caton fellow, the one you sent your article to, was in for the chair at Abertawi at the same time. Well, anyway, Haynes gave me the impression that Caton might well have got the chair instead of him, only there was something rather shady about him. Of course, this new journal of his may be quite above board, but I thought I ought to let you know so that you can take any action you think fit with regard to your article. After all, it's important to you, isn't it?
This was the cue Dixon had been hoping for, to force Welch to reveal what had been decided about his future. Yes, sir. Actually, I've been meaning to ask you about that.
About what?
Well, I'm sure that you appreciate, Professor, that I've been worrying rather about my position here in the last few months. I've been wondering just how I stand. Welch's head lifted slowly.
I don't quite see...
My probation.
Oh, that. Well, you're on 2 years probation here, Dixon, not 1 year.
Yes, I know, but that doesn't mean that I can't be asked to leave at the end of my first year.
Oh, no, Welch said. No.
He left it open whether he was reinforcing Dixon's negative or dissenting from it. Well, I'm just wondering what's happening about it, that's all.
Yes, I've no doubt you are, Welch said in the same tone. I'll let you know as soon as anything's decided.
The examinations were in progress, and Dixon had nothing to do that morning. He grinned at this thought, then stopped doing that on entering the common room and catching sight of Margaret, pale and heavy-eyed, on her own, near the empty fireplace. Oh, hello, dear. How are you today? Dixon said.
All right, thanks.
He smiled tentatively. You don't sound as though you mean that.
Don't I? I'm sorry. I'm perfectly all right, really.
She spoke with extraordinary sharpness. He said, as gently as he could, "Now, Margaret, please don't talk like that. If you don't feel too good, tell me about it, and I'll sympathise. But if you feel all right, that's fine. But for God's sake, don't try to pick a fight with me. I don't feel like one." As he finished, she gave a loud sob. "Margaret," he said in horror, "don't cry. I didn't mean it." But she gave a furious downward wave of her hand.
"You were quite right," she said. "It was my fault. I'm sorry. You're the only one that's nice to me, and then I treat you like that."
"Oh, never mind about that. Tell me what's wrong."
"Oh, just another bad night. I didn't get off till 4, and it's made me terribly sorry for myself, as usual."
Dixon sweated quietly as she talked on. Some invitation or promise was obviously required. "What about lunch today?" he said. "Are you free?"
"No. Mrs. Welch is having a luncheon party. I must go now." Slowly and inefficiently, she started looking for her handbag.
"Margaret, when shall I see you again?"
"I don't know."
"Shall I get Neddy Welch to ask me down for tea at the weekend?"
"If you like. Bertrand will be there, though." With an almost imperceptible increase in emphasis, she added, "He's coming down for the summer ball."
Dixon felt like a man who knows he won't be able to jump onto the moving train if he stops to think about it. "Are we going to that?" he said. 10 minutes later, it having been established that they were going to that, Margaret was on her way out, all smiles. Dixon was glad that his trump card had had such a spectacular effect. But, as is the way with trump cards, it had looked better in his hand than it did on the table.
"Professor Welch, Professor Welch, please."
Dixon huddled himself further into the periodical he was reading. He wished that the porter would go away before his eye fell on him. Welch was known to be taking the whole day off, as distinct from days like yesterday, the day of their conversation about Dixon's job, when Welch merely took the early and late morning and the afternoon off. But it was no use. In a moment, the porter approached him and said huskily, "Mr. Jackson."
Dixon wished he had the courage to twist himself about in his chair in search of this quite new and unknown character.
"Yes, McConachie," he said. "Oh, Mr. Jackson, there's a lady on the telephone for Professor Welch, but I can't seem to find him. Would you take the call for him, please?"
"Yes, all right," Dixon said. "It must either be Mrs. Welch or some poor half-crazed creature connected with the arts. Mrs. Welch would be better in that her message would be comprehensible, but worse in that she might have found out about the sheet, or even about the table." He picked up the phone and said,
"Dixon here."
"Who?"
It was a vaguely familiar voice. "Dixon, I'm taking the message for Professor Welch."
"Oh, Mr. Dixon, of course. This is Christine Callahan." "Oh, hello, how are you?" "I'm fine, thanks. How are you? I hope you've had no more trouble with your bedclothes."
No, I'm glad to say that's all blown over. Touch wood.
Oh, good. Look, perhaps you can tell me, do you know if Professor Welch is expecting Bertrand down?"
"Well, yes, as it happens, I do know that Bertrand's coming down at the weekend. Margaret Peel told me."
Evidently, this girl didn't know she'd been junked by Bertrand, at least as far as the summer ball was concerned.
"I see. Did she happen to mention whether Bertrand will be going to your summer ball affair?"
"No, I'm afraid not." She must have sensed his puzzlement.
"I expect you're wondering why I don't ask Bertrand himself," she said. "But at the moment he's just sort of gone off, and my uncle, Mr. Gore Urquhart, got back from Paris sooner than he expected, and he's got an invitation from your principal to the summer ball thing. Well, I could persuade him to come if Bertrand and I were going, and then Bertrand and he could get to know each other. But I must know soon, because uncle would want to know in good time. It's rather a mix-up, I'm afraid."
"Well, can't Mrs. Welch throw any light on the matter?"
There was a pause. Then she said, "I've not actually been on to her. We didn't hit it off too well when I stayed."
"I see. Well, I've got a suggestion. I'll ring up the Welches for you now and get the professor to ring you. I'll see to it somehow or other that Mrs. Welch doesn't get involved. If it's no good, I'll ring you back myself and tell you. Will that do?"
"Oh, that'd be lovely. Thank you so much. What a marvellous idea. Here's my number. It's the place I work at."
While he took it down, Dixon assured himself several times that Mrs. Welch couldn't have found out about the sheet or the table, or Margaret would surely have warned him.
"Right, I've got that," he said finally. "It's good of you to do this for me," the girl said.
"Will you be going to the ball thing?"
"Yes, I'm afraid so."
"Afraid so?"
"Well, I'm not really much of a dancing man, you know. It'll be a bit of an ordeal for me, I'm afraid."
"Yes, I understand. I'm not much good as a dancer myself, really."
"Oh, well, we'll be able to sit out together, then."
That's a bit forward, he thought. "Thank you again for your help," she said.
"Not at all. I hope very much you will be coming on Saturday."
"I hope so, too. Well, goodbye. I may be hearing from you later, then."
"That's right. Goodbye."
Alone in the common room, Dixon picked up the phone again. Things happened very quickly. In less than a quarter of a minute, Mrs. Welch said, "Celia Welch speaking." In his preoccupation, he'd forgotten about Mrs. Welch. Still, why worry? In an almost normal tone, he said,
"Can I speak to Professor Welch, please?"
"That's Mr. Dixon, isn't it? Before I get my husband, I'd just like you to tell me, if you don't mind, what you did to the sheet and blankets on your bed when you..."
He wanted to scream. His dilated eyes fell on a copy of the local paper that lay nearby. Without stopping to think, he said, distorting his voice by protruding his lips into an O,
"Oh, Mrs. Welch, there must be some mistake. This is the Evening Post speaking. There's no Mr. Dixon with us, I'm quite sure."
"Oh, well, I'm most awfully sorry. You sounded at first just like... how ridiculous of me."
"Quite all right, Mrs. Welch, quite all right.
I'll get my husband for you straight away."
"Well, actually, it was Mr. Bertrand Welch I wanted to speak to, really," Dixon said, smiling at his own cunning as best he could with a distorted mouth.
"I'm not sure whether he's, just a minute."
She put down the phone.
Better hang on, Dixon thought. The information Mrs. Welch had obviously gone to get was just what he wanted for the Callahan girl. Yes, hang on at all costs. One of the costs was immediately presented in the form of a well-remembered voice baying directly into his ear.
"This is Bertrand Welch."
"Evening Post here," Dixon managed to quaver.
He recovered slightly. We'd like to do a little paragraph about you for our Saturday page, he said, beginning to plan. That's if you've no objection.
Objection? Objection? What objection could a humble painter have to a little harmless publicity? At least, I take it is harmless.
Quite harmless, I assure you, sir. We have a few facts about you already, naturally, but we would just like to know what you're engaged on at the moment, you see.
Of course, most reasonable. Well, I've got a couple of things in hand just now. There's a rather splendid nude. Then there's a self-portrait, an outdoor one, against a brick wall. More wall than Welch, as a matter of fact. The real idea is the pallor and sort of crumpledness of the clothing against the great, red, smooth wall. A painter's picture, more or less.
I see. Well, that'll do us nicely, Mr. Welch, Dixon said. The young lady said something about an exhibition, sir. Would that be right?
What young lady is this?
A Miss Callahan, sir. I gather you know her.
Yes, I know her, Bertrand said in a slightly hardened voice.
Where does she fit into this?
Why, I thought you must know, Dixon said with feigned surprise. She knows one of our staff here, and I gather she put the notion of this little paragraph to him. You see, sir?
Oh, really? Well, it's the first I've heard of any of it. Well, it all sounds most...
I should check with her, sir, if you're in any doubt. As a matter of fact, when your Miss Callahan was on the blower to Atkinson...
Atkinson? Who's this Atkinson character? I've never heard of him.
Oh, our Mr. Atkinson in the London office, sir. She was on to him just now, sir, and asked us to ask you to ring her if we could get hold of you. Seems she couldn't get through to your house or something. Something pretty urgent seems to have come up, and she'd like you to ring her up this afternoon, if you would.
All right, I'll do that, then. What's your name, by the way, in case I...
Beasley, sir, Dixon said, without hesitation.
Right, thank you, Mr. Beasley. Have you got everything you want?
Oh, yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir.
No, no, thanks to you. So long, old boy.
Dixon sat back, mopping his face. Panic had made him fearfully rash, but not, he thought, irretrievably so. The Callahan girl must be carefully coached in the following story, that some unknown, calling himself Atkinson, had rung her up and, posing as a journalist, discussed Bertrand. He'd obtained the Welch's number and rung off. And when Bertrand came through on the phone, she must greet him at once with the Atkinson story, saying it all sounded very fishy to her. And provided she held to her story, they were completely safe. Yet again, he picked up the phone. After a moment, he leaned forward and said,
Miss Callahan, it's Dixon here. Now, listen carefully.
As Dixon executed a turn at the corner of the dance floor, Margaret said,
Honestly, James, Carol Goldsmith couldn't have been more livid. Her eyes absolutely flashed fire. I can't say I blame her, having it thrown at her across the tea table like that, in front of me and the Welches.
What was actually said? Dixon asked.
Well, Bertrand just said, Oh, by the way, Carol, I've been meaning to tell you that Christine's coming to the dance after all, and she's bringing her uncle, Gore Urquhart, with her. Then he went on. He would be only too pleased to escort you, I'm sure. And that was that. The man's quite impossible, James, though it struck me at the time. Do you think there's anything, well, going on between Bertrand and Carol? It's really rather odd that he should ever have been taking her to the ball, and then her looking so furious. Anyway, I think she's done a good deal better for herself with Mr. Gore Urquhart. I must say, he seems most charming.
Before Dixon had time to reply, the dance wheeled to an end, and he saw Bertrand and Christine Callahan approaching. Christine wore a yellow dress that managed to reveal Margaret's royal blue taffeta with a quadruple row of pearls as decidedly ill-judged.
"Well, what goes forward, people?" Bertrand asked.
"I thought we might go and have a drink," said Dixon. Gore Urquhart and Carol Goldsmith were sitting in the bar. When he saw them, Gore Urquhart rose to his feet. He was younger than Dixon had expected, somewhere in the middle 40s. And to Dixon's surprise and delight, he was holding a pint glass. Dixon said, Hey, how did you manage to get pints? I haven't seen anything but halves in here the whole evening. I thought it must be a rule of the place. How on earth did you get round it? While he said this, he saw irritably that Margaret was smiling deprecatingly, as if to assure Gore Urquhart that, despite all evidence to the contrary, this speech betokened no real mental derangement. Gore Urquhart jerked a thumb towards the porter, McConachie. A fellow Scottish nationalist, he said. Bertrand settled himself next to Gore Urquhart and began talking in a low voice. With a flourish of trumpets, the music started up in the ballroom and people began to move out of the bar. On Dixon's left, Bertrand said,
"I've the utmost respect for his opinion. He knows what he's talking about, which is more than you can say for most of the critics nowadays. Well, we kept running into each other at the same exhibitions and, funnily enough, in front of the same pictures. One day he said to me, 'I want to see your work. People tell me it's good.' So I packed up an assortment of small stuff and took it round to his house. It's a lovely place, isn't it? You must know it, of course. One might really be back in the Dies Vitae M. And I must say that one or two pastels seemed to fetch him. Fetch him a vomiting basin, Dixon thought. And yet here was the Gore Itchbag fellow, not on the face of it a moron, listening to this frenzy of self-advertisement without overt protest, even with some attention. Bertrand was now using the phrase contrapuntal tone values, so Dixon switched to his right, where for some moments he'd been half conscious of a silence. As he did so, Christine said in an undertone, "Look, do join in this, will you? I can't get her to say anything." He looked over at Carol, whose eyes met his without apparent recognition. But before he could start working on what to say, Margaret said, "Mr. Gore Urquhart, I'm not going to permit any more of this skulking about in here. It's the light fantastic for you. Come along." Gore Urquhart, smiling politely, let himself be led away. Bertrand looked across at Carol.
Don't let's waste the band, my dear," he said. "I've paid 25 shillings for 'em, after all."
"So you have, my dear," Carol said. And for a moment, Dixon was afraid she meant to refuse, and so bring the situation, whatever it was, to a crisis. But after a moment, she got to her feet.
"Care for a dance?" Dixon said to Christine. "I'm not much good, as I told you, but I don't mind having a crack if you don't."
She smiled.
"Nor do I, if you don't."
Dixon kept careful control over his features to stop them breaking out into an imbecile smirk of excitement and pride. When Christine turned and faced him at the edge of the floor, he found it hard to believe that she was really going to let him touch her, or that the men near them wouldn't spontaneously intervene to prevent him. But in a moment, there they were, in the conventional pseudo-embrace, actually dancing together.
"What was the matter with Mrs. Goldsmith?" she asked.
"She did look rather fed up, didn't she?" Dixon fenced.
"Was it because she was expecting Bertrand to bring her here tonight instead of me?"
Oh, did that mean she knew about the switch of partners?
I don't know," he said. "Oh, Amber, I never got a chance to thank you for playing up so well over that phone business."
"What phone business?"
"You know, me pretending to Bertrand that I was a reporter."
"Oh, that. I'd sooner not discuss that, if you don't mind."
She couldn't be allowed to get away with that.
"Well, supposing I do mind. You seem to forget that, but for my little impersonation, you probably wouldn't be here at all tonight."
She shrugged. "I'm sorry. That was silly of me. I didn't mean to be like that. But you see, I don't feel like discussing it with you because that would be like laughing at Bertrand behind his back. That's all." The whole thing sounded rather childish, but better that than peevish. Dixon was saved from having to reply by the intervention of an enormous, half-incoherent voice, which now began to sing through the loudspeakers with an intonation rather resembling Cecil Goldsmith's, "I'll be parp to get you in a taxi, honey, you'd better be ready about parp 8. As they moved down the floor away from the band, Christine asked, "How are you getting on with Professor Welch these days?"
"Oh, not too badly," Dixon said mechanically.
"Hasn't he been on to you about that phone call?"
He couldn't stifle a howl, but hoped the music would drown it.
"You mean Bertrand did find out it was me pretending to be the reporter that time?"
"No, I wasn't talking about that. I meant the phone call from that man in your digs, that Sunday at the Welch's."
As the body of a decapitated hen is said to go running about the farmyard, Dixon's legs continued to perform the requisite dance steps. "He knows that I arranged for Atkinson to tell me my parents had come down.
Who told him?"
"Please don't dig your nails into my back. It was that little man who played the oboe, Johns."
"Evan Johns?"
"That's right. He seems to have got it in for you, rather."
"How did he say he got to know about this?"
"Oh, he said he was there when you were arranging it."
"Oh, he must have been listening outside the door. I remember thinking I heard something."
At the end of the dance, they moved off to the bar again, where they found Gore Urquhart being talked to by Bertrand as if their conversation had never been interrupted. Margaret was in even closer attendance, if possible. But where was Carol? Just then she appeared, walking with a kind of deliberate carelessness that made Dixon suspect her of having a bottle of something hidden in the lady's cloakroom. The expression on her face boded ill for somebody, or perhaps everybody. She turned to Dixon.
"Come on, Jim. I want you to dance with me. I take it that nobody here will object."
The floor seemed fuller than ever. The noise was enormous.
"He thinks he's only got to crook his ruddy finger and I'll come running," Carol announced in a shout. "Well, the great painter's mistaken. Of course, he knows he isn't great, really, and that's what makes him behave like this. Great artists always have a lot of women, so if he can have a lot of women, that makes him a great artist, never mind what his pictures are like. You can guess who the women are in this case. Me and the girl you've got your eye on."
Dixon started insincerely. "What the hell are you talking about?"
"Oh, don't waste time, Jim. What are you going to do about it?"
"Well, nothing."
"Worried about what dear Margaret would do? You let dear Margaret stew in her own juice. I've met people like that before, and believe me, it's the only way. Throw her a life belt and she'll pull you under. I suppose you've guessed I've been sleeping with our friend the painter, haven't you?"
He began to feel frightened.
"No, I hadn't."
"You're a bit shocked, aren't you?"
"Well, no, not that exactly. It's just that, oh, he seems such a queer fish for you to have gone for."
"No, not so queer as all that. He's very attractive in his way. And, well, old Cecil isn't much of a boy for that kind of business." After a short pause, Dixon said,
"Well, how have you managed to keep all this out of Cecil's way?"
"Oh, you don't think I haven't told him about it, do you? I wouldn't dream of doing anything behind his back."
Dixon reflected, not for the first time, that he knew absolutely nothing whatsoever about other people or their lives.
"The only thing to settle now is what you're going to do about Christine, Jim."
"I've told you nothing."
"She's a bit out of my class, don't you think? Oh, I'd only get sent off with a flea in my ear."
"You sound as if you're in love with her."
"Do you think so?"
"Yes.
Your attitude measures up to the two requirements of love. You want to go to bed with her and can't, and you don't know her very well. Ignorance of the other person, topped up with deprivation, Jim."
"Oh, that's rather adolescent, isn't it?"
"Yes, it is, isn't it? Let's go back to the bar, shall we? It's so noisy in here. And don't forget now, you've got a moral duty to perform. Get that girl away from Bertrand. She wouldn't enjoy an affair with him. Wouldn't be her kind of thing at all."
They re-entered the bar. Dixon felt that he'd been doing this for weeks. The sight of their party, just where they'd been before, made him want to pitch forward on the floor and go to sleep. Bertrand was talking, Gore Urquhart was listening, Margaret was laughing. Christine, her back to Dixon, was sitting as immobile as if she'd been mummified. A sudden douche of terror squirted itself all over Dixon, and after a moment he realized that this was because he had a plan and was about to carry it out. He went and sat down next to Christine.
"Hello," she said. "I thought you must have gone home."
"Not quite. You look as if you're being rather left out of things."
At that moment, Bertrand got up and, without looking in Christine's direction, walked across to where Carol was standing. Dixon said quickly, "Now listen to me, Christine. I'm going to order a taxi. It should be here in about a quarter of an hour. You come outside then and I'll take you back to the Welches." Her immediate reaction looked like anger.
"Why? Why should I?"
"Because you're fed up, and no wonder. I'll give you 20 minutes. "He must be out of his mind to be talking to a girl like this. "Please come," he said. He turned and left. She wouldn't, of course. But at any rate, he'd made his gesture. In other words, he'd thought of a way of hurting himself more severely than usual, and in public. He stopped for a moment to wave goodbye to the band, then, receiving no response, he went off to find a phone. Dixon paused in the portico to light the cigarette which, according to his schedule, he ought to be lighting after breakfast on the next day but one. The taxi he'd ordered was due any minute. If by the time he'd finished his cigarette, Christine had still not appeared, he'd just asked the taxi man to take him to his digs. After about 25 minutes, he not only had no Christine, but no taxi. Then a car rounded the corner from the main road. It was a taxi. A voice from the driver's seat said, "Taxi for Professor Barker."
"Barker?" Dixon said. Oh, you must mean Barclay, don't you? Oh, yes, that's it, Barclay. Good. Yes, we're nearly ready. Just back into that side turning, will you? I'll be back in a couple of minutes. Don't let anyone else hire you, mind.
Dixon nerved himself to contemplate going back and trying Christine again, but without delay, Professor Barclay appeared, followed by his wife, as the taxi was just beginning to reverse cautiously into the side turning where it would be hidden. As Barclay came up to the portico, it still had several yards to go. Dixon barred his path. Good evening, Professor Barclay.
Oh, hello, Dixon. Haven't seen a taxi waiting for me, have you?
Oh, good evening, Mrs. Barclay. No, I'm afraid I haven't, Professor.
Oh, dear, he said. Well, we shall just have to wait, then.
Are you waiting for a taxi, too, Mr. Dixon? Mrs. Barclay asked. No, I just came out to get a breath of fresh air.
You've had time for several lungfuls, the professor said, smiling.
His amiability made Dixon a good deal ashamed of having stolen his taxi, but it was too late to withdraw. He hoped fervently that his own taxi, the one he'd ordered, wouldn't take it into its head to turn up. He glanced desperately up the corridor as two people appeared round the bend almost together. The first one wasn't Christine. The second one was. Glancing over at the line of cars, Christine said abruptly, "Did you manage to get one?" Dixon knew that the Barclays would be listening. He hesitated, then said, "Yes," and patted his pocket. "I've got it here." He tried to get her to walk off with him, but she stayed where she was in the doorway. "No, I meant a taxi."
A taxi? A taxi for 300 or 400 yards?
He gave a shuddering laugh.
I'll have you back with Mum in less time than it'd take to phone. Good night, Professor. Good night, Mrs. Barclay. Well, it's a good thing we haven't far to go.
When they were far enough away, he added, Well done. What's going on? Christine asked.
We pinched their taxi. It's parked just round this corner.
As if answering its name, the taxi, tired of waiting, emerged from the side street and pulled up towards the main road. Dixon ran furiously off in pursuit, calling loudly for the Barclays' benefit, "Taxi! Taxi!" It drew to a stop, and he went up to the driver's window. After a brief conversation, the taxi moved off again. Dixon ran back to Christine, whom the Barclays had now rejoined. "Oh, sorry I couldn't get him for you," Dixon said to them. "He'd got someone to pick up at the station in 5 minutes." "Oh, what a nuisance!"
"Oh, well, thank you very much for trying," Barclay said.
Calling good night, Dixon took Christine's arm and walked her round into the side street. "Does that mean we've lost the taxi?" "No, I told the driver to wait round the corner for us." The taxi was parked outside the lighted windows of a dress shop. Dixon said to the driver, "Our friend isn't coming. We'll make a start if you're ready." He got in beside Christine, and the car started. "That was all very efficient," Christine said. "You're getting good at this sort of thing, aren't you? First the table, then the Evening Post thing, and now this."
"Well, I'm glad you decided to come with me, after all. What finally made up your mind?"
After a silence, she said, "I don't see why I should tell you, but I left because I was feeling absolutely fed up with everything. I've been feeling very depressed recently, and it all seemed to get too much for me tonight."
"Oh, a girl like you's got no call to be depressed about anything," Dixon said warmly.
He was filled with awe at the thought that she seemed not only not to dislike him to any significant extent, but to trust him as well. The admissions about his feelings for her that he'd made to Carol Goldsmith had seemed outlandish at the time, but now they seemed perfectly natural and just. And the next half hour or so formed the only chance he'd ever have of doing anything whatever about those feelings. For once in his life, Dixon resolved to bet on his luck. "You haven't any reason to be depressed," he repeated.
"I don't see how you can know that," she said.
"You see, I find some things awfully difficult. I don't really know my way around, you know." She hesitated. Then she said, "It's all to do with men, you see. I hadn't much to do with men until I got my job in London last year. Anyway, after a few months, I met Bertrand. He can be very nice, you know, though I don't suppose you... Well, anyway... After a bit, the thing was, I was starting to get rather fond of him, and at the same time I was getting a bit fed up with him. He's such a queer mixture, you see. He can be extremely understanding and kind one minute and completely unreasonable and childish the next. I feel I never know where I am with him or what he really wants. Anyway, we started having rows. There'll be a row over tonight, and he'll put me in the wrong as usual. But he's in the wrong. All this business with Mrs. Goldsmith, it's all right, I'm not going to ask you about it, but I know there's something going on there, but he won't tell me what's happening."
"Look, this is none of my business, Christine, but
In my opinion, friend Bertrand's letting himself in for you giving him the air.
No, I can't do that. I'm in too deep now. It'll have to go on as it is. Not wanting to speculate what it was, Dixon asked hurriedly, Have you and he got anything planned for the future? Well, I haven't, but I think he may. I've got an idea he wants us to get married, though he's never actually mentioned it. And what do you feel about that? I haven't decided yet. From what you've seen of us both, do you think it would be a good thing if I got married to Bertrand? This was clearly the moment for a burst of accurate shelling from Dixon in his Bertrand war. But he found himself reluctant to fire. He only said, I don't think I know either of you well enough, but I should say no. I see. Why not? Because I like you, and I don't like him. Is that all? Sounds a bit thin to me. All right, if you want reasons, Bertrand's a bore. He's like his dad. The only thing that interests him is him. Even if that were true, it needn't prevent me from marrying him. Oh, I know women are dead keen on marrying men they don't like much. But I'm saying why you oughtn't to marry him, not whether you're going to or not. Are you in love with him?
I don't much care for that word, she said, as if rebuking a foul-mouthed tradesman.
Why not?
I don't know what it means.
Oh, come on, it's a word you must have often come across in conversation and literature.
You're going to tell me it sends you flying to the dictionary each time. If you can tell whether you like greengages or not, you can tell me whether you're in love with Bertrand or not. If you want to tell me, that is.
No, you're making it much too simple. All I can really say is that I'm pretty sure I was in love with Bertrand a little while ago, and now I'm rather less sure. After a few moments, she yawned. I feel awfully sleepy. Would you mind if I had a nap for a few minutes?
Oh, of course. By all means.
Dixon fought his disappointment at this device of hers for quitting his company. He thought he was getting on so well. Just then she laid her head on his shoulder, and all his senses grew alert. You don't mind, do you? She asked. The back of this seat's like iron.
You go ahead.
Forcing himself to act before he could think, he slid his arm beneath her shoulders. Gingerly, he moved a little closer. At last, the taxi stopped at the end of the track that led up to the Welch house. Christine woke up and said after a moment, Are you coming up? I'm not quite sure how I'm going to get in.
Of course.
Dixon settled a brief exchange with the taxi driver by refusing to discuss the question of payment until the taxi should be standing outside his digs. Then he went off into the darkness with Christine holding onto his arm like a staff.
I think we'd better look for a window, he said.
He led the way towards the French windows and found they weren't even latched. He pulled the door slowly open and stepped into the room. He moved slowly forward, arms outstretched, until he found the light switch. He snapped the switch down, and the room sprang into light about them. They looked at each other, both smiling and blinking. Then the smile left Christine's face and was replaced by a look as of anxiety. Dixon, very slowly, to give her all the time she might need to step back and away, put his arms round her. He kissed her for some seconds. She felt very warm. At length, she did step back. Dixon felt as if he'd been running for a bus and had, in addition, been nearly knocked down by a car at the moment of boarding. He could only say, Well, that was very nice. Yes, wasn't it? Worth coming back from the dance for? Yes.
He half promised himself to send Gore Urquhart a box of 25 Balkan Sobrani for involuntarily engaging Margaret's attention at the dance and so making the taxi stratagem conceivable.
I'm very fond of you, he said. He caught a glimpse of her starchier manner as she replied, How can you be? You hardly know me.
Oh, I know enough to be sure of that, thanks.
Tell me, how long are you staying here?
For a few days. It's part of my holiday.
Oh, grand. When can you come out with me?
Oh, don't be such a fool, Jim. How can I possibly come out with you?
Oh, no trouble at all. You can make out you're with Uncle Julius.
Do you realise what you're asking me to do? Bertrand asked me down here, and I'm his... Well, I'm tied up with him. Can't you see yourself how mean it would be?
No.
Well, what about Margaret, then?
Well, she's got no real claim on me, you know.
Hasn't she?
She seems to think she has.
Look, would you like to come out with me, forgetting about Bertrand and Margaret for the moment?
You know I would, she said.
Why do you think I let you take me away from the dance?
So you did.
He put an arm around her shoulders, and they kissed more earnestly than before. When he let her go, she said, All right, then, but I still think it's a dirty trick. What do you suggest?
We could have dinner.
No, I don't think we'd better arrange anything for an evening, if you don't mind.
Well, what about tea, then?
Oh, yes, tea would be fine.
Monday?
No, I can't on Monday. What about Tuesday?
Fine, 4 o'clock.
He'd hardly explained how to get to the hotel where they were to meet when the unmistakable sound of a car became audible.
My God, here they are, he said.
What are you going to do?
I'll wait until they've started coming in at the front door and then nip out by the window. You close it after me.
They stood with their arms round each other while the car's engine, after a terrible rattling roar, petered out.
Thanks for a lovely evening, Christine.
Good night, Jim.
They kissed for a moment, then she propelled him to the window. He scuttled out and saw her blow a kiss into the darkness while she fastened the latch. Then the curtain fell back.
Dixon, gripping his pencil like a bread knife, wrote,
Dear Mr. Johns, this is to let you know that I know what you are up to with young Marlene Richards. She is a decent girl, and I won't have you filing her head with a lot of art and music. She's too good for that, and I am going to marry her, which is more than your sort ever do. So just you keep of her, Mr. Johns. This will be your only warning. Just do as I say, or some of my pals from the works will be up your way, and we shan't be coming along just to say how do, you can bet. So just lay off, young Marlene, if you know what's good for you. Yours faithfully, Joe Higgins.
Dixon knew he could hardly hope to deceive Johns for long, especially since Johns had almost certainly got no further with Marlene Richards, a typist in his office, than staring palely at her. But the letter would, at any rate, give him a turn. As he was reading it through, Margaret came into his room. She was wearing the green paisley frock and the quasi-velvet shoes.
"Hello, Margaret," he said, with a heartiness which originated, he realised, in a guilty conscience. "How are you? Have a seat."
She remained standing.
"Do you hate me, James?"
Dixon wanted to rush at her and tip her backwards into the chair behind her.
"How do you mean?" he asked. It took her a quarter of an hour to make clear how she meant. She talked fast, moving about a lot, her hair jerking to restore invisible strands of hair. Why had he deserted her at the ball like that? Or rather, since she and everyone else knew why, what did he think he was up to?
Dixon knew from experience that to counter-attack Margaret was invariably mistaken, but he was too angry to bother about that. He said, with his heart pounding, I don't see why you're kicking up all this fuss. You were all over that gore itchbag character. I've never seen such an exhibition in my life.
She stared at him, wide-eyed.
James, you don't know what you're talking about. I talk to a man just for a few minutes and you start accusing me of making up to him.
Oh, I used to think you understood me, James, but now, you see, when you say a thing like that, I don't mind it being offensive and all that, but what makes me so unhappy is the awful gulf it shows there is between us.
Dixon didn't make a face. He was afraid she might see it reflected in the window pane.
After you'd gone last night, I didn't spend a single moment with Gore Urquhart. He was with Carol Goldsmith. I spent the rest of the time with Bertrand, thank you very much.
Well, hard luck, Dixon broke in, before he could have time to relent. A grandiose disgust for the whole proceedings had filled him. He remembered Carol's phrase about not throwing Margaret any life belts. Well, he'd thrown his last one. Now, look here, Margaret, he said. I've no desire to hurt your feelings unnecessarily, but for your own sake, as well as mine, you must get something straight.
I agree, I was probably in the wrong over the dance business. But right or wrong won't make any difference to this. I'll stick up for you, and I'll chat to you, and I'll sympathise, but I've had enough of being forced into a false position. You can count me out as far as any sex business is concerned. I've entirely lost interest in you.
You don't think she'd have you, do you? A shabby little provincial bore like you,
Margaret burst out.
Or has she had you already?
Oh, don't be fantastic, Margaret. Come off the stage for a moment, do.
There was a pause, and then she seemed to collapse onto the bed. Unregarded, her spectacles fell off. She was making a curious noise, a steady, repeated, low-pitched moan. Dixon didn't know what to do.
As he began speaking her name, she threw herself violently backwards. He seized her wrists. She looked at him with dilated eyes and began struggling. Footsteps were now approaching outside. The door opened and Bill Atkinson came in.
"Hysterics, eh?" he said, and slapped Margaret several times on the face. "There's some whiskey in my cupboard. Go and get it."
Dixon ran out and up the stairs. He found the whiskey. His hand was shaking so much he nearly dropped the bottle. Down in his room again, he found everything much quieter. Atkinson looked up.
Get a glass or a cup.
Margaret had stopped moaning and she was trembling less violently. Her face was red from Atkinson's blows. When Atkinson put the cup to her mouth, it rattled once or twice on her teeth, but quite soon she stopped trembling altogether.
"Sorry about that," she said faintly.
"That's all right, girlie," Atkinson said.
"Were you the one that slapped my face?" she asked.
"That's right. Did you a power of good. How do you feel now?"
"A lot better, thanks."
"Good. Well, put your feet up and have a rest. Have some more whiskey, but don't let Jim get at it. I promised his mother not to let him drink himself to death."
"Thank you so much, Mr. Atkinson. You've been wonderful."
"That's all right, girlie." He nodded and went out.
"I'm sorry about all that, James," Margaret said as soon as the door was shut.
"Oh, no, it was my fault."
"No, you always say that. This time I'm not going to let you. I just couldn't take what you said, that's all. And then I simply lost control of myself. You were absolutely right saying what you did."
"Look, I'd better come back to the Welches with you," he said.
"My dear, I wouldn't hear of it. You'd better keep clear of that place as long as you can." Then, looking into her compact mirror, she said, "It's strange that it should end like this, isn't it? But you've got nothing to reproach yourself with. Really, I don't know how you stuck it. Just as well you decided to call it quits." She snapped the compact shut and put it into her handbag.
"You know, I'm fond of you, Margaret," Dixon said. "It's just that it wouldn't work, that's all."
"I know, James. Don't worry. Now I must be off, or I shall miss my bus. I dare say we shall run into each other before long. Goodbye."
"Goodbye, Margaret. See you soon." She went out without replying. Dixon tried to tell himself that he was glad about having told Margaret what he'd been wanting to tell her for so long, but it wasn't convincing. He thought about his appointment with Christine, but some part of what had happened in the last half hour had spoiled all that. He picked up Atkinson's whiskey bottle and went to the door. Then he turned back for the letter to Johns. There seemed no point in not posting it. Dixon plunged down the stairs at 8:15 the next morning, not so much so as to be sure of being there while Johns read his Joe Higgins letter, as because he wanted, or rather had got, to spend a long morning in writing up his Merry England lecture for the college open week. The previous evening he'd tried working his notes into a script. The first page of notes had yielded a page and 3 lines of script. At that rate he'd be able to talk for 11.5 minutes. Some sort of pabulum for a further 48.5 minutes was evidently required. He'd have to get Barclay to find him a book on medieval music. 20 minutes at least on that. "It may perhaps be thought," he muttered to himself, "that the character of an age, a nation, a class, would be but poorly revealed in anything so apparently divorced from ordinary habits of thought as its music." He leant forward impressively over the cruet. "Nothing could be further from the truth." At that moment, Beasley entered.
"Hello, Jim," he said. "Post here yet?"
"Oh, no, not yet. It shouldn't be long now."
Beasley started on his cornflakes as Atkinson came slowly into the room. This morning he looked more than ever like Genghis Khan meditating a purge of his captains. While Miss Cutler, their landlady, was dispensing vermilion bacon, the day's post could be heard arriving. Dixon felt none of the pleasurable excitement he'd expected, even when a couple of minutes later Johns came silently in, holding his letter. Beasley, his mouth full of food, stopped chewing and nodded significantly at Dixon. Johns opened his letter and began reading. Atkinson, outwardly unconcerned, was watching Johns through his thick lashes. The silence was intense. After reading the letter through once or twice, Johns stuffed it quickly into his breast pocket. He picked up his spoon so hurriedly that it spattered milk over his navy blue cardigan.
"What's the matter, sonny boy?" Atkinson asked.
Had a bit of bad news? No. No, nothing at all. Atkinson lit a cigarette. Not much of a talker, is he? He asked the other two. No, they said. Atkinson nodded and went out. They heard his rare laugh gradually receding up the stairs.
It isn't funny, John said suddenly and surprisingly. It isn't funny at all.
What isn't? Dixon asked.
You know what, Dixon. Two can play at that game, you'll see.
The encounter ended with no more said, and with a last hostile glance, John's hurried out. His work on the college staff's superannuation policies began at 9 o'clock. Beasley leaned over.
All right, eh, Jim?
Oh, not too bad.
Hey, what's up, Jim? You don't look too happy. Still worrying about the lecture? Look, I've got those notes on the Age of Chaucer I promised you. There'll be a few things you can probably use. I'll stick them in your room.
Dixon cheered up. If he could dare to wait long enough, he might be able to construct the rest of his lecture entirely out of other people's efforts.
Thanks, Alfred, he said. Going up to college?
Oh, yes. I want to see Barclay to pick his brains on medieval music.
Grand. I'll go up with you.
When they entered the main building, they went into the common room and moved to their separate pigeonholes. In a moment or two, Beasley came over, holding a newly arrived journal of university affairs to which he subscribed.
Something that'll interest you here, Jim. New appointment, Dr. L.S. Caton, to the Chair of History of Commerce, University of Tucumán, Argentina. Isn't that the chap you sent your article to?
God, let me have a look.
You'd better get through to him a bit sharpish before he escapes on the banana boat.
Yes, yes, I will. Thanks, Alfred. I'd better find Barclay before he gets a job out there, too. A prey to vague but powerful misgiving, Dixon hurried over to the music school, where, to his surprise, Professor Barclay proved to be in possession of just the sort of book Dixon wanted. Feeling a little less disturbed, he went to the library and obtained a book on medieval costume and furniture. On the way out, he met Welch.
Oh, good morning, Professor.
Welch recognized him almost at once.
Dixon, he said.
He was looking more than usually wild-eyed and dishevelled this morning. There was a small golden emblem on his tie, which proved on closer scrutiny to be congealed egg yolk.
Dixon, do you think you could go to the public library for me, if you're not too overburdened with work just now? Your lecture for Wednesday, I suppose it's complete.
Dixon shifted the two books he had under his arm in case Welch might be able to see their titles.
Oh, yes, he said. Good. You'll be all right for the external examiners' meeting tomorrow, I take it? 5 o'clock in my room?
Christine was meeting Dixon at 4 o'clock the next day. Even with a taxi, he could only have 3/4 of an hour with her. He wanted to bundle Welch into the revolving door and whirl him around in it till lunchtime. He said, I'll be there.
Good. Now, as it regards what I want from the library...
He drew a sheaf of papers from his breast pocket.
It's all quite self-explanatory, you'll find. The reference is down in nearly every case, I think. Yes, oh, there are a few here, yes, without... Well, I don't suppose there's much of value, if anything, but you might just like to look through the subject indexes. If there aren't any, then you'll just have to use your own... your own. Right. Well, I won't hold you up. I expect you want to get started.
Dixon turned away, only to start violently as a loud thundering noise broke out behind him. Welch, his hair flapping, was straining to push the revolving door into the college library in the wrong direction. After a time, somehow divining his error, he began pulling instead at the now jammed door. Then, with a sudden bursting click, the door yielded and Welch overbalanced, hitting his head on the panel behind him. Dixon went away feeling it was things like this that kept him going. Several hours later, after Dixon's return from the public library, Welch said,
Well, that's really splendid, Dixon. You've filled in the gaps in really quite admirable.
For a moment he gloated over the notes Dixon had made for him. Then suddenly added,
I was wondering if you were doing anything this evening. I thought you might like to come over and have a meal with us.
After a day of doing Welch's research, there was plenty for Dixon to do in connection with his own lecture, quite apart from his fears of encountering Mrs. Welch again, but it was obvious that he couldn't afford to turn down this offer. So he said unhesitatingly, Well, thank you very much, Professor. That's very kind of you. Welch gathered up the notes.
I think this ought to go down very well tomorrow night, he said, turning on Dixon his sexual maniac smile.
Ah, I'm sure it will. Who's the talk being delivered to?
The Antiquarian and Historical Society. I'm surprised you haven't seen the posters.
He put his fawn fishing hat on his head.
Come along, then. We'll go down in my car.
Oh, that'll be nice. The journey passed uneventfully. Welch's driving seemed to have improved slightly. At any rate, the only death Dixon felt himself threatened by was death from exposure to boredom. Welch went on talking, his own face the perfect audience, laughing at his jokes, reflecting his puzzlement or earnestness, responding with tightened lips and narrowed eyes to the more important points. He went on talking even as he brought the car to rest within a couple of inches of the inner wall of the garage. Then he got out. Dixon, casting about for means to leave the car, rejected the 6 inches between the door and the side wall nearest him, and after some bad-tempered leg play with the gear and brake levers, slid across the front seat to the other door. As he did this, something seemed to pluck at the seat of his trousers. He felt behind him, and found he could comfortably insert his first 2 fingers into a rent in the material. A glance at the driver's seat showed the tip of what must have been a broken spring just emerging from the upholstery. He began slowly to follow Welch. Why hadn't Welch torn his own vile trousers on the barbed seat? Perhaps he had, without noticing. As Dixon passed under the thatched barbette over the front door, another member of the Welch family manifested itself, a young ginger cat called Id. It was the only survivor of a litter of 3. The other 2, Mrs. Welch had christened Ego and Super Ego. Trying his best not to think of this, Dixon bent and tickled Id under the ear. He admired it for never allowing either of the senior Welches to pick it up. "Scratch 'em," he whispered to it. "Pee on the carpet." It began to purr loudly. As soon as Dixon had joined the company within, the leisurely tempo of his day jerked abruptly into frenzy. Welch wheeled towards him. Christine, more apple-cheeked even than he remembered her, was grinning at him in the background. Margaret turned her back. Welch said energetically,
Faulkner.
Dixon's nose twitched his glasses up. Yes, Professor?
At least, Dixon.
He hesitated, then went on with unprecedented fluency.
I'm afraid there's been a bit of a mix-up, Dixon. I'd forgotten that we'd all promised to go to the theatre this evening with the Goldsmiths. I shall just have time to change and freshen up and drive us into town. There'll be room for you if you want a lift. I'm sorry, but I shall have to rush off now. We must have you over another time.
Before he was out of the room, Mrs. Welch moved up like an actress dead on her cue. Bertrand was at her side. Rather red in the face, she said,
Mr. Dixon, I've been wondering when I should see you again. I've 1 or 2 points I want to take up with you. First of all, I'd like you to explain, if you can, just what happened to the sheet and blankets on your bed when you were our guest here recently.
I don't quite know what Dixon mumbled.
Am I to understand that you deny having had anything to do with the matter?
No, Dixon broke in. I don't deny it. Please, Mrs. Welch, I'm desperately sorry about it all. I know I should have told you about it, but I was afraid to. Will you send me the bill for what it cost you to replace it? Thank God they still didn't know about the table.
Before we discuss that, Mr. Dixon, I want to hear exactly how the damage was caused.
I know I've behaved very badly, Mrs. Welch, but please don't ask me to explain that. It's nothing very terrible, I assure you.
Then why do you refuse to say what it is?
I'm only asking you to spare me a lot of embarrassment that wouldn't help you at all. Bertrand now joined in.
We can put up with that, Dixon. It'll be some kind of small return for the way you've behaved. Among other things, I'm convinced it was you who rang me up recently from London and pretended to be a newspaper reporter.
Dixon was about to admit it, but remembered in time that this would incriminate Christine.
I can't imagine why you should think any such thing. I haven't been away once this term. How could I have phoned through from London if I was here all the time?
Bertrand looked questioningly at his mother.
I told you were wrong, he said peevishly. I told you old David West was behind all this. Damn it, Christine was certain it was him on the phone.
It was clear that Bertrand had got nothing out of Christine. Has that cleared things up? Dixon asked politely. Mrs. Welch began to go red again.
I think I'll just go and see how your father's getting on, darling, she said, and left the room.
Bertrand moved a pace closer.
I've been wanting us to have a little get-together for quite some time, old boy. Ever since that ball affair, in fact.
And what precisely was your game the other evening when you induced Christine to skip out of the dance with you?
What do you mean? Dixon said. I wasn't playing any sort of game.
Now, don't be funny, Dixon. What did you intend doing with Christine? That's what I want to know.
Well, I intended doing exactly what I did, to bring Christine back here in a taxi and finally to return to my digs in the same taxi.
Well, I'm not having that, do you understand? If I find you playing that sort of trick again, I'll break your horrible neck for you and get you dismissed from your job as well. Understand?
Oh, yes, I understand, but if you think they chuck people out of academic jobs for taking their professor's son's girlfriend's home in taxis, you're wrong.
Don't think you can defy me and get away with it, Dixon, Bertrand said. People never do.
Dixon was saved from replying by the approach of Christine and Margaret. Christine took Bertrand by the arm and led him out of the room. Margaret silently offered Dixon a cigarette.
That was about the dance business, wasn't it? She asked.
Yes, he was trying to persuade me to keep off the grass. They went out into the hall where Welch, now wearing a blue serge suit of startlingly extravagant cut, was waiting.
I'll just go and bring the car around, he said,
and off he went. As he did so, Dixon saw Christine coming down the stairs towards him. She smiled. I hope you didn't have too bad a time with Bertrand.
Bertrand? Oh, no. It was all right.
They went outside, and after a moment, Bertrand joined them on the step. He was wearing a blue beret, which had much the same effect on Dixon as Welch Senior's fishing hat. If such headgear was a protection, what was it protection against? They stood apart from each other for a few moments. Then Welch's car came bouncing round the corner, and they moved towards it. Mrs. Welch joined them, not looking at Dixon. A scramble for places ensued before, in the kangaroo mode to which it must by now be accustomed, the car started on its journey. Dixon was passing by the telephone situated in Miss Cutler's drawing room when it rang. He picked up the receiver, and a voice that was quite strange to him said, "Have you a Mr. Dixon living there, please?"
Speaking.
"Oh, Mr. Dixon, my name's Catchpole. I expect you've heard of me from Margaret Peel."
Dixon grew tense.
"Yes, I have," he said.
It wasn't the sort of voice he'd have expected Catchpole to have.
"I rang up because I thought you might be able to give me some news of Margaret. I've been away recently, and I hadn't managed to hear anything of her since I got back. How is she these days, do you know?"
"Why don't you get hold of her and ask her yourself? Or perhaps you've tried that and she won't speak to you."
"Well, I can understand that." "Mr. Dixon, I can't understand why you're taking that tone. I just wanted to know whether Margaret's all right or not."
Dixon calmed down at this appeal.
"Well, she's in quite good health physically. Mentally, she's about as well as can be expected."
"Oh, thanks very much. I'm glad to hear that. But why were you so angry when I asked you about her?"
"Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it?"
"Not to me, I'm afraid. I can't think of any reason why you should have a grudge against me."
It sounded remarkably sincere.
"Well, I can," Dixon said, unable to keep the puzzlement out of his voice.
"There's some kind of mix-up here, I can see that. I'd like to meet you sometime, if I may, and try to straighten things out."
Dixon hesitated.
"All right, well, what do you suggest?"
They arranged to meet for a drink on Thursday. When Catchpole had rung off, Dixon sat for some minutes smoking. Then, with a sigh, he referred to the pocket diary for 1943, in which he wrote down telephone numbers, pulled the phone towards him again, and gave a London number. In a little while, he said, "Is Dr. Caton there, please?" There was another brief delay, then a rich, confident voice came over the line.
"This is Caton."
Dixon gave his name, and for some reason the richness and confidence of the other voice waned sharply.
"What do you want?" it asked.
I read about your appointment to the University of Tucumán, Dr. Caton, and I was wondering what was going to happen to that article of mine you were good enough to accept for your journal. Can you tell me when it'll come out?"
Now, Mr. Dickerson, things are very difficult these days, you know."
The voice was confident again.
"You really mustn't expect your article, which I liked very much, I may say, to go in 5 minutes, you know."
"No, I appreciate that, Dr. Caton. I was just wondering if you could give me some sort of tentative date, that's all. It's rather important to me."
"I can't start making promises to have your article out next week," the voice said in a nettled tone, as if Dixon had been stupidly insisting on this one point. "You don't seem to realise the amount of planning that goes into each number, especially the first number. It's not like drawing up a railway timetable. What? What?"
A hollow metallic tapping had begun on the line, like galvanised iron being hammered in a cathedral.
In a louder voice, Dixon said, "No, I'm sure it isn't, and I'm quite resigned to the delay, but to be quite frank, Dr. Caton, I want rather urgently to improve my standing in the department here, and the vaguest estimate would help me. The second half of next year, for example?" There was a silence, which Dixon interpreted as one of maturing rage. "Could I have your permission to say the second half of next year when I'm asked?" Though Dixon waited for 10 seconds or more, nothing answered him except the metallic tapping, which had increased in volume and pace. Muttering to himself, Dixon went up to his room, where he got out the notes for his lecture, and went on working them up into a script. 5 hours later, he had what he estimated as 44 minutes' worth. He stopped writing and ran out into the bathroom. He started washing with frenzied speed. He'd left it just late enough. With luck, he'd have time to get ready and rush along to the hotel for tea with Christine, but no time to think about tea with Christine. Nevertheless, he began to feel a little queasy with apprehension. Dixon arrived at the hotel 2 minutes late. On turning into the lounge, he felt a pang of fear, or whatever emotion it was, when he saw Christine already waiting for him. He'd counted on a few minutes' grace to think of things to say to her. She smiled as he approached. "Hello, Jim. How are you?"
Hello. All right, thanks. You managed to get away without any fuss."
"I think Bertrand was rather suspicious. I told him there were one or two things I wanted to do in town. It made me feel rather mean." She put her elbows on the table between them. "In a way, I think it was rather a bad thing, my coming to meet you at all. But I'd said I would, and so I had to come. And of course I still wanted to, just as much as I did when you asked me. But I've been thinking it over, and I've decided... Look, shall we have our tea first and then talk about it?"
"No. Tell me now."
"All right, then. It's this, Jim. I think I was a bit carried away when you asked me to come. I think I wouldn't have said yes if I'd had time to think what I was doing. You can see what I'm leading up to, can't you?"
"You mean you don't want to go on with this?"
"Well, I don't really see how we could go on with it, do you? The only chance we'd have to see each other would be when Bertrand asked me to come and stay with his parents, like now. And I wouldn't feel right about sneaking off to see you the whole time. And in any case..." She stopped, which caused Dixon to turn round. A youthful waiter had approached, and was now shifting from one foot to the other. Dixon thought he'd never seen a human frame radiating so much insolence without recourse to speech or any contortion of the features. When Dixon said, "Tea for two, please," the waiter smiled faintly, as if in lofty but sincere commiseration, then swung away.
What were you saying?" Dixon said.
"It's just that I'm, tied up with Bertrand, that's all. I'm afraid all I can ask you to do is try to understand."
"You're going back on what you said about being rather fed up with him, then?"
"No, all that's still true. But I can't go about expecting people to behave as I want them to the whole time." The waiter reappeared with a loaded tray. This he dropped to within an inch of the table. Then, with an offensive exaggeration of care, he laid it soundlessly to rest. Straightening up, he paused as if to emphasize his non-intention of setting out any of the tea things, and moved off, counterfeiting a heavy limp. Christine began pouring tea. When she gave him his cup, she said, "I'm sorry, Jim, I didn't want to be like this about it. But after all, you've got your commitments with Margaret, haven't you?" Dixon sighed. He felt that his role in this conversation, as indeed with anything to do with Margaret, was being directed by something outside himself. "Yes," he replied. "Things have all rather come to a head in the last few days, as a matter of fact. Since the ball, really." She looked at him quickly. "There was a row over that, was there?"
"Well, yes, I suppose you could say that."
"Well, there you are, you see. What did she say to you?"
"Oh, all sorts of things." Dixon drank some tea. "It's all so complicated. There's a lot of past history that's all mixed up with it, you see. She's a decent girl, really, and I like her a lot. At least, I would, if only she'd let me. I don't think she knows quite how interested I've been in you, by the way, and I don't imagine she'd thank me for telling her."
Christine said, "You sound pretty miserable about the whole business. I don't suppose you want me to say this, but I don't see how either of you can be very happy with the other one." Dixon tried to suppress his irritation.
"No, I don't suppose we can."
"What are you going to do, then? Are you going to get engaged to her?"
"I don't know," he said coldly, trying not to think about getting engaged to Margaret. "I suppose it's possible." She didn't seem to notice his unfriendly tone.
"Well, it looks as if we're both taken care of, doesn't it?"
It's just as well. The vapidity of this reacted with Dixon's general feeling of peevish regret and made him begin to talk fast. Oh, yes, there's not really much to choose between us. You'll keep up your little affair with Bertram because you think that on the whole it's safer to do that than to chance your arm with me. And I'll stick to Margaret because I haven't got the guts to turn her loose and let her look after herself. So I do that instead of doing what I want to do because I'm afraid to. It's just a sort of stodgy, stingy caution that's the matter with us. You can't even call it looking after number one. He looked at her with faint contempt and was hurt to see the same feeling in the way she looked at him. I think I'll go now, Jim, she said. There's not much point in... No, no, don't go, Dixon said in agitation. Things were happening much too fast for him. Are we ever going to see each other again? Well, once more, anyway. I'm coming to your lecture, and to the sherry party at the principal's before it. Oh, God, Christine, you don't want to come to that. You'll be bored stiff. How have you let yourself in for that? Uncle Julius has been asked by the principal, and it seems he said he'd come in a weak moment, and now he insists on me coming to keep him company. Oh, well, I shall see you at a distance then, anyway. Christine stood up, and so did Dixon. This time I really am going. Thank you for the tea. Give me your address, Christine. She looked at him scornfully. What would be the point? Well, it would make me feel that we hadn't seen the last of each other. Well, there's no point in feeling that, is there? She went quickly past him and out of the room without looking back. Dixon sat down again and smoked a cigarette with an almost cold half cup of tea. He wouldn't have thought it possible that a man could feel so violent a sense of failure and general uselessness. With relief, Dixon finished writing the last words of his lecture. He got up and did his ape imitation all round the room. He jumped up and down on the bed with bent knees, gibbering to himself. A knock at his door was followed so quickly by the entry of Bertrand that he only had time to stop gibbering. Bertrand, who was wearing his blue beret, looked at him. What are you doing up there? I like it up here, thanks. Any objection? Come down and stop clowning. I've got a few things to say to you. He seemed in a controlled rage and was breathing heavily. Dixon jumped down to the floor. What do you want to say? Just this. The last time I saw you, I told you to stay away from Christine. I now discover you haven't done so. I know all about your surreptitious little cup of tea with her on the sly yesterday. Oh, she told you, did she? Bertrand tightened his lips behind the beard, which looked as if it could do with a good comb-out. Of course she didn't. If you want to know, it was one of your so-called pals in this house who told my mother about it. Everybody hates you, Dixon, and my God, I can see why. Anyway, the point is, I want an explanation of your conduct. Oh, dear, Dixon said with a smile. I'm afraid that's rather a tall order. Explain my conduct? Now, that is asking something. I can't think of anybody who'd be quite equal to that. He was watching Bertrand closely, filing away the news of this latest blow from Evan Johns. Who else could it be? There was a pause. Then, in a quieter voice, Bertrand said, Look here, Dixon. You don't seem to quite appreciate what you've got yourself into. This business between Christine and myself is serious. We've known each other for some considerable period of time, and it's distinctly on the cards that I might marry Christine in a couple of years. Now, Christine's very young. She's not used to having individuals abducting her from dances and inviting her to off-the-record tea parties. Very soon she's going to start feeling guilty about it and wishing she'd never agreed to meet you at all. And that's where the trouble's going to start. Being the sort of girl she is, she's going to feel bad about getting rid of you and about doing things behind my back. Well, I want to prevent all that. Now, does that make sense? Dixon lit a cigarette to hide the effect on him of this account of Christine's motives. It was more penetrating than he'd have expected from Bertrand. Oh, yes, it makes sense, all right, up to a point, he said, in what he hoped was a casual tone. But it's my turn to tell you something now. The serious part of this business isn't anything to do with you and Christine. It's to do with me and Christine. What's happening isn't me unnecessarily distracting her from you. It's you unnecessarily distracting her from me. Bertrand faced Dixon with his teeth clenched. Just get this straight in your so-called mind. When I see something I want, I don't allow people of your sort to stand in my way. Dixon moved a pace nearer. You're getting a bit too old for that to work any more, Welch. People aren't going to skip out of your path indefinitely. You're a twister and a snob and a bully and a fool. You think you're sensitive, but you're not. Touchy and vain, yes, but not sensitive. And you're so dishonest that you can tell me how important Christine is to you without it entering your head that you're carrying on with some other chap's wife all the time.
What the hell are you talking about? Your spot of the old slap and tickle with Carol Goldsmith. That's what I'm talking about. All right, you've got it coming, Bertrand bayed furiously. I warn you!
Dixon took off his glasses and put them in his top jacket pocket. They faced each other on the floral rug, elbows crooked in uncertain attitudes. Bertrand jabbed at Dixon's face. Dixon stepped aside, but his feet slipped, and before he could recover, Bertrand's fist had landed with some force high up on his right cheekbone. A little shaken but undismayed, Dixon stood still, and while Bertrand was still off his balance after delivering his blow, hit him very hard indeed on the larger and more convoluted of his ears. Bertrand fell down, making a lot of noise in doing so, and dislodging a china figurine from the mantelpiece. It exploded on the tiles of the hearth, emphasizing the silence which fell. After some seconds, Bertrand began moving about on the floor, but made no attempt to get up. Dixon put his glasses on again, feeling good. There was a quiet knocking at the door. "Come in," Dixon said, with reflex promptness. Mitchie, the ex-service student, entered. "Good afternoon, Mr. Dixon," he said, then added politely, "Good afternoon," to the still prostrate Bertrand, who at this stimulus struggled to his feet. "I seem to have come at an inconvenient time." "Oh, not at all," Dixon said smoothly. "Mr. Welch is just going." Bertrand shook his head, not in contradiction, but apparently to clear it. And Dixon moved host-like to the door with Bertrand. "Goodbye," Dixon said to his departing back, and then turned to Mitchie. "And what can I do for you, Mr. Mitchie?" Mitchie's expression, though as usual unreadable, was a new one to Dixon. "I've come about the special subject," he said. "Oh, good. What conclusion did you come to?" "Well, I'm sorry to say that all three of the ladies have decided that the thing's rather too formidable for them. But I've decided that your subject attracts me a good deal, and so I'd like to be put down officially for it, if I may."
"Oh, so I shall just have you?"
"Yes."
Dixon scratched his chin. "Well, I'm sure we shall have some fun with it. See you next term, then, Mr. Mitchie."
"I'm coming to your lecture tonight, of course," Mitchie said. "You should have a very good house, I think."
When he'd gone, Dixon reflected with some complacency that Mitchie hadn't called him sir once. But how horrible next term was going to be. On the other hand, he was beginning to feel more and more positively that there wasn't going to be a next term, as far as he was concerned. As McConachie, the porter, appeared with a tray of glasses of sherry, Dixon willed his hand to stay at his side until the principal and Gore Urquhart had helped themselves. Then he let it bear the fullest remaining glass to his lips. He felt slightly ill, but swallowed half his new glassful at one go. It slid warmly down to join the previous three sherries and the half-dozen measures of Bill Atkinson's whiskey. In a sense, but only in a sense, he was beginning not to worry about the lecture, which was to start in 20 minutes' time. He looked round the crowded common room, which seemed to contain everybody he knew or had ever known, apart from his parents. He felt like going round and notifying each person individually of his preference that they should leave. After a moment, the principal moved over to some local worthies, leaving Dixon with Gore Urquhart, who said, "How long have you been in this game, then, Dixon?"
Getting on for 9 months."
"I've a notion you're not too happy in it, am I right?"
Yes."
"Where's the trouble? In you or in it?"
Both, I should say. They waste my time and I waste theirs."
"It's a waste of time teaching history, is it?" Dixon resolved not to mind what he said to this man.
"No. Well taught, history could do people a hell of a lot of good. But in practice, it doesn't work out like that. Things get in the way. Bad teaching's the main thing. Not bad students, I mean."
Gore Urquhart shot a quick glance at him.
"This lecture tonight, whose idea was it?"
Professor Welch's. I could hardly refuse, of course. If it goes well, it'll improve my standing here."
"You're ambitious."
No, it's not that. I've done badly here since I got the job. This lecture might help to save me getting the sack." One of the aldermen came over and drew Gore Urquhart off to join the group around the principal. Dixon went up to Christine and Bertrand.
"Hello, you two," he cried gaily.
"Run away and play, Dixon," Bertrand said. "I didn't come here to talk to you. I came here simply and solely to get hold of Gore Urquhart."
"Why, hello, Bertie dear," Carol Goldsmith said behind him. "Come over here, will you? I shan't keep you a minute."
She gripped his arm.
"I'll return him in good condition," she added over her shoulder to Christine.
"Well,
Hello. Christine, Dixon said.
Hello. What's the matter with your eye?
Bertrand and I had a fight this afternoon.
A fight? Well, you didn't say anything to me about it. You lost by the look of you.
Not at all. Take a look at Bertrand's ear before you start deciding who won and who lost.
Which one?
The right. But there probably won't be much to see. The damage was mostly internal, I should think.
My God. She stared at him. And a pang of helpless desire made Dixon feel heavy and immovable, as if he were being talked to by Welch. His spirits were so low that he wanted to lie down and pant like a dog. Their conversation was brought to an end by the drift of the principal's group towards the door. Welch called,
Ready, Dixon?
See you in the hall, Professor, he called back, then hurried out into the staff cloakroom. Stage fright was upon him. His legs felt like flaccid rubber tubes filled with fine sand. While he was using the lavatory, he began making his evil-in-war face, then abandoned it in favour of one more savage than any he normally used, alternately dilating and crossing his eyes. Turning away, he found himself confronted by Gore Urquhart. He allowed his face to collapse and said, Oh, hello. Hello, Gore Urquhart said. Dixon took from a shelf the stolen RAF file that contained his lecture script and was about to leave when Gore Urquhart added, Feeling a little nervous, laddie?
Very.
Gore Urquhart nodded and produced a slim flask.
Have a swig.
Dixon took a good pull at what was evidently neat Scotch whisky. He wiped his mouth on his sleeve and gave the flask back.
Thanks. I'm very grateful.
It'll do you a part of good. Well, we'd best get along if we don't want to keep them waiting.
Dixon found that he felt rather drunk. On the platform, Welch uttered the preludial blaring sound with which he was accustomed to call for silence at the start of a lecture. A hush gradually fell.
We are here tonight, he informed the audience, to listen to a lecture.
Dixon, so as not to have to listen to what was said, looked furtively round the hall. It was certainly very full. On the point of groaning involuntarily, he tried to will himself into feeling all right. Only nervousness, he told himself. And the drink, of course.
When Welch said, Mr. Dixon, and sat down, Dixon stood up, his knees shaking violently. A loud thunder of applause started up, chiefly, it seemed, from the gallery. With some difficulty, he took up his stand at the lectern. The applause died away slightly, enough for sounds of laughter to be heard. Then it gathered force again, reaching a higher level than before. The gallery had had its first clear view of Dixon's black eye. The principal, Dixon saw, was staring irritably at the area of disturbance. In his own general unease, Dixon, who could never understand afterwards how he came to do it, produced an excellent imitation of Welch's preludial blaring sound. The uproar grew louder. The principal rose slowly to his feet. The uproar died down. After a pause, the principal nodded to Dixon and sat down. Dixon smoothed the edge of his script and began. But when he'd spoken about half a dozen sentences, he realized that something was still wrong. The murmuring in the gallery had grown louder. Then he realized what it was. He'd gone on using Welch's manner of address. In an effort to make his script sound spontaneous, he'd inserted an, of course, here, you see there, and nothing so firmly recalled Welch as that sort of thing. Sweating, he struggled on. As he talked, he glanced round the front rows. He noticed that Christine was whispering something to Carol and seemed agitated. So that this shouldn't put him off, he looked further afield, trying to pick out Bill Atkinson. Over the whiskey bottle an hour and a half earlier, Atkinson had announced his intention of pretending to faint should Dixon, finding things getting out of hand in any way, scratch both his ears simultaneously.
It'll be a good faint, Atkinson had said. It'll create a diversion, all right, don't you worry.
Recalling this now, Dixon had to fight down a burst of laughter. At the same moment, a disturbance nearer the platform attracted his attention. Christine and Carol were leaving. Flustered, Dixon half tripped against the base of the lectern and swayed perilously forward. A hum of voices began again from the gallery. He stopped speaking. When he recovered himself, he found that he'd lost his place. He cleared his throat, found his place, and went on in a clipped tone. It was some moments before he realized that he was now imitating the principal.
With a shaking hand, he poured himself a glass of water and drank feverishly. A comment, loud but indistinct, was shouted from the gallery. Dixon felt he was going to burst into tears. Should he throw a feint? It'd be easy enough. No, no, everybody would assume he'd succumbed to alcohol. He made a last effort to pull himself together, but slowly things began to go wrong for the third time. A feeling, not so much of drunkenness, but of immense depression and fatigue, was taking almost tangible shape in his head. Almost unconsciously, he began to adopt an unnameable foreign accent, and to read faster and faster, as if in a dream he heard Welch stirring, then talking at his side. He began punctuating his discourse with snorts of derision. He read on, turning over the pages like a score reader following a presto movement, raising his voice higher and higher. Below him, the local worthies were staring at him with frozen astonishment. The only person in the main body of the hall who was actually producing sounds was Gore Urquhart, and the sounds he was producing were of loud, skirling laughter. Shouts, whistles and applause came from the gallery. It was too much, and Dixon put his hands over his ears. Then, through all the noise, a louder noise became audible, something between a groan and a bellow, as halfway down the hall, Bill Atkinson collapsed full length in the aisle. Dixon felt that he was in the grip of some vertigo. His head seemed to be swelling and growing lighter at the same time. He sank to his knees, half hearing the principal's voice saying above the tumult, "From finishing his lecture through sudden indisposition, I'm sure you'll all..." "I've done it now," he managed to think, before everything faded out in a great roar of wordless voices. "That's all it was," Beasley said the next morning. "Quite understandable. You can plead nervousness and the heat and so on. After all, you did pass out." "They'll never forgive me for wrecking a public lecture, though," said Dixon. "And nervousness wouldn't make me imitate Welch and the principal, would it?" They went in through the college gates. Three students hanging about there nudged each other as Dixon passed. In the common room, his stomach turned over as he recognised Welch's handwriting on a note in his pigeonhole. He went upstairs reading it. Welch felt he ought to let him know, unofficially, that when the council met next week, he would be unable to recommend Dixon's retention on the staff. He would furnish what testimonials he could for any application Dixon might make for a new job, provided it were outside the city. He himself was sorry Dixon had got to leave, because he'd enjoyed working with him. There was a P.S. telling Dixon he needn't worry about the matter of the bedclothes. For his part, Welch was prepared to consider it settled. Well, that was decent of him. Dixon felt a stab of conscience at having spent so much of his time and energy in hating Welch. Back at his digs, he heard the phone ring, and in a few moments Miss Cutler tapped at the door. "Someone on the telephone for you, Mr. Dixon." "Well, who is it?" "Well, I'm afraid I didn't get the name." When he picked up the phone, a woman's voice said, "Is that Mr. Dixon? One moment, please." Baffled, he waited. Then a man's voice said, "Gore Urquhart here. Got the sack, have you?" Yes. "Good. Then I won't have to break her confidence by telling you so. What are your plans?" "Well, I was thinking of going in for school teaching." "Are you set on it?" "Not really." "Good. I've got a job for you. $500 a year. You'll have to start at once on Monday. It'll mean living in London. You accept?" What job is it?" "A sort of private secretarial work, mainly meeting people. We'll go into the details on Monday morning, 10 o'clock at my house in London." He gave the address, then said, "Right then, I'll see you. Just a minute, Mr. Gore Urquhart. Shall I be working with Bertrand Welch?" "Whatever gave you that idea?" "Well, I gathered he was after a job with you." "That's the job you've got. I knew young Welch was no good as soon as I set eyes on him, like his pictures. It's not that you've got better qualifications. You haven't got the disqualifications, though, and that's much rarer." When it rang off, Dixon got up slowly. What noise could he make to express his frenzy of hilarious awe? He drew in his breath for a growl of happiness, but was recalled to everyday affairs by a chime from the clock on the mantelpiece. It was 12:30, the time he was supposed to be meeting Catchpole to discuss Margaret. Leaving the house, he dwelt with exultation on Gore Urquhart's summary of the merit of Bertrand's pictures. Then his walk lost its spring, as he realised that Bertrand, jobless and talentless as he was, still had Christine.
Catchpole turned out to be a tall, thin man in his 20s. After a few preliminaries, he said, "I think the best thing I can do is to give you the true facts of this business. Firstly, Margaret and I were never lovers in either the emotional or what I might call the technical sense. But I found myself, without knowing how, going about with her. Well, quite soon I realized that she was one of those people who feed on emotional tension. We began to have rows about nothing. I was perpetually being accused of ignoring her, all that kind of thing. Well, after a particularly senseless row, I decided that I didn't want any more of it. I told her so. There was the most shattering scene. Well, finally, to keep her quiet, I agreed to go round and see her that evening about 10 o'clock. When the time came, I couldn't face going. A couple of days later, when I found out about her attempting suicide, I realized that that was the very evening I'd been supposed to go and see her. It gave me a bit of a shock.
"Wait a minute," Dixon said with a dry mouth. "She asked me to go round that evening as well. I remember the whole thing quite clearly. As a matter of fact, we'd just been buying the sleeping pills she must have used in the evening."
"When was this?"
"Oh, about midday, I suppose. Why?"
Catchpole said slowly, "She bought a bottle of pills while she was with me in the afternoon."
They looked at each other in silence. Then Catchpole said bitterly, "We were both supposed to be there then, and see what we'd driven her to. Oh, I knew she was neurotic, but not as neurotic as that.
It pretty well confirms what I've always thought. Margaret had no intention of committing suicide. She must have taken some of the pills before we were due to arrive, not enough to kill her, of course, and then waited for us to rush in and reproach ourselves. Well, I'm extremely grateful to you for helping to sort this out. Thanks to you, I'm completely free of her now. No more worrying about how she is, thank God. That's worth a great deal."
He finished his drink and stood up. "And you're free of her too, I hope." He leaned forward. "Don't try to help her any more. It's too dangerous for you. I know what I'm talking about. She doesn't need any help either, you know, really."
They shook hands and Catchpole strode out. Dixon finished his drink and left a couple of minutes later. Miss Cutler provided lunch at 1 o'clock. On entering the dining room, Dixon encountered Bill Atkinson sitting at the table reading a new number of the wrestling periodical to which he subscribed. He looked up.
"Just had your popsy through on the blower," he said.
"Oh, God, what did she want?"
"I don't mean the one that gets me down. I mean the other one, the one you say belongs to the bearded sportsman."
"Christine? What did she want?"
Atkinson turned to the front page of his journal. After reading attentively something he'd written in the margin, he said,
"I didn't get all of it, but the main thing is her train goes at 1:50. She said she had some news for you, and that if you wanted to see her again, you could see her off. It was up to you, she said, and she'd understand if you didn't come."
Atkinson added that the train was leaving not from the main city station, but from the smaller one near Welch's house. Dixon ran out into the street. A couple of hundred yards away, a bus was coming slowly up the hill. Dixon ran faster towards the corner of College Road, but the bus reached it before him. When he next saw it, the bus was halted about 50 yards away up College Road, and someone had just got on. Dixon broke into a frenzied, lung-igniting sprint, while the conductor watched him immobile from the platform. When Dixon was halfway to the bus, this official rang the bell. Dixon found he was even better at running than he'd thought, but the gap between man and bus began to widen rapidly. Dixon stopped running and favoured the conductor, who was still watching unemotionally, with the best-known obscene gesture. At once, the conductor rang the bell again, and the bus stopped abruptly. Dixon hesitated for a moment, then trotted lightly up to the bus and boarded it with some diffidence. He found himself unwilling to meet the eye of the conductor, who now said admiringly, "Well run, Whacker," and rang the bell for the third time. Dixon climbed effortfully to the top deck. There he made his way to the front seat and collapsed. As he looked out of the window, he couldn't help feeling some sort of exhilaration. Then his face altered. The bus had moved up behind a lorry slowly drawing along an elaborate trailer, which had a notice on it recommending caution and saying how many feet long it was. Lorry, trailer and bus began moving at a steady 12 miles an hour round what gave promise of being a long series of bends. The conductor now appeared and Dixon asked about the bus's time of arrival at the station. "Shall we be on time, do you think?"
"Not if we keep crawling behind this contraption, we shan't." They entered a long stretch of straight, empty road. Far ahead, a hand appeared from the lorry's cab and made a beckoning movement. But the driver of the bus ignored this invitation in favour of drawing to a gradual halt by a bus stop outside a row of thatched cottages. Two old women dressed in black waited until the bus was quenched of all motion before edging with caution out of Dixon's view towards the platform. In a moment he heard their voices crying unintelligibly to the conductor. Then activity seemed to cease. At least 5 seconds passed. Dixon stirred elaborately at his post. Was the driver slumped in his seat, the victim of syncope? Or had he suddenly got an idea for a poem? Then the picture of sleepy, rustic calm was modified by the emergence from a cottage some yards beyond of a third old woman. She looked keenly towards the bus, then approached with a kind of bowed shuffle that suggested the movements of a serviceman towards the pay table. A metallic noise came from the back of Dixon's throat when he saw her smile of self-admiration at having caught her bus. Dixon found that his whole being had become centred in the matter of the bus's progress. He couldn't be bothered any longer to wonder what Christine would say to him if he got there in time, nor what he'd do if he didn't. The bus was now resolutely secured again behind the trailer, which soon began to reduce speed even further. But before Dixon could cry out, the lorry and trailer moved off into a lay-by, and the bus was travelling on alone. Now was the time, Dixon thought with reviving hope, for the driver to start making up some time. The bus slowed abruptly and stopped. Making a lot of noise, a farm tractor was laboriously pulling at right angles across the road something that looked like the springs of a giant's bed. Dixon thought he really would have to run downstairs and knife the drivers of both vehicles. What next? What next? A masked hold-up? An electric storm with falling trees and meteorites? A low-level attack by communist aircraft? The driver stung by a hornet? He'd choose the last of these if consulted. The bus crept on again. As the traffic thickened slightly towards the town, the driver added to his unnatural caution a psychopathic devotion to the interests of other road users. The sight of anything between a removal van and a junior bicycle halved his speed to 4 miles an hour. Learners practiced reversing across his path. Toddlers retrieved toys from under his just-revolving wheels. Dixon's head twitched angrily to and fro in vain search for a clock. And then, seeing the railway station 30 yards off, he rattled along the aisle to the stairs. Before the bus had reached the station stop, he plunged across the road and into the booking hall. The clock over the ticket office pointed to 1:47. Dixon flung himself at the barrier. A hard-faced man confronted him. Which platform for London, please? The man looked at him appraisingly, as if trying to gauge in advance his fitness to hear a more than usually improper joke.
Bit early, aren't you?
Eh?
Next to London's 8:17.
8:17? What about the 1:50?
No 1:50. Haven't got it mixed up with the 1:40, by any chance.
Dixon swallowed. I think I must have done, he said.
Bill Atkinson must have made a mistake.
It wasn't like Atkinson to make mistakes.
Perhaps it had been Christine who'd made the mistake. But it didn't really matter. He walked slowly to the entrance. He still had his job, and it wouldn't be very difficult to get in touch with Christine. It was only that he felt it would be too late when he did.
As he wondered what to do next, he caught sight of a car with a damaged wing moving uncertainly round a post office van. Something about this car held Dixon's attention. It began to crawl towards him, roaring like a bulldozer. The roar was cut off in its tracks. A tallish blonde girl carrying a large suitcase got out and began to hurry towards the spot where Dixon stood. Dixon skipped out of sight behind a pillar. How could he, of all people, have ignored the importance of Welch's car-driving habits? Christine came into view 4 or 5 feet away, turned her head, and saw him at once. Her face broke into a smile of what seemed to him pure affection. "You've got my message, then," she said. She looked ridiculously pretty.
"Come here, Christine, quickly."
He drew her into the shelter of his pillar. She stared about her, and then at him.
"My train's nearly due."
"Your train's gone. It went at 1:40.
"But Mr. Welch said it went at 1:50.
"He was wrong.
"Are you sure? Why are we hiding? Are we hiding?"
Ignoring her, Dixon leant carefully past her. Welch's car was now broadside on across the main exit from the square. Well, just give the old fool time to get clear, and then we'll go and have a drink. I know a hotel not far from here. Used to go there with Margaret, in the old days.
They left Christine's case in the luggage office and walked out into the square.
A good thing old Welsh didn't insist on putting you on the train, Dixon said.
Yes. Actually, I was the one who insisted. I wanted to get away from the whole bunch of them.
What happened that you wanted to tell me?
I finished with Bertrand.
For good?
Yes. You remember me and Carol Goldsmith leaving your lecture in the middle yesterday?
Dixon understood and felt breathless.
I know what she told you. Christine said, you knew about Bertrand and her all the time, didn't you?
Yes.
Why didn't you tell me?
Why, I couldn't. Wouldn't have done me any good.
What made Carol tell you? She said she hated Bertrand for taking her for granted. I didn't mind what he'd done before he started going about with me, but it was wrong of him to try to keep us both on a string. Carol and me. Carol said she began by hating me, and then she saw the way he was treating me, and that he was the one to blame, not me.
A leer of happiness suffused Dixon's face. He said, I think you might like to hear this. I am going to have nothing more to do with Margaret. Something's come up, which means I needn't bother with her any more. I'll tell you all about it later, but first, what are you going to do this afternoon?
Well, I suppose I shall go back to London.
Do you mind if I come with you?
What's all this?
She pulled at his arm until he looked at her.
There's something else, isn't there?
What is it?
Didn't Uncle Julius tell you about my new job?
When he'd explained, Christine said, I knew he had something up that sleeve of his. I didn't know that'd be it, though.
What job is it, by the way?
The one Bertrand thought he was going to get. Christine began laughing noisily.
As Dixon laughed too, he thought what a pity it was that all his faces were designed to express rage or loathing. Now that something had happened which really deserved a face, he'd none to celebrate it with. Instead, he drew in breath, then blew it all out again in a final and glorious howl of laughter before he allowed Christine to lead him away up the street.
Jim, how I envy him. Oh, lucky Jim, how I envy him.
And Martin Jarvis was reading from Lucky Jim by Kingsley Amis. It was abridged and produced by Pat McLaughlin.